Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Remains of more than 300 children have been found at Indigenous boarding school sites in Canada. Hundreds of schools like these also existed in the U.S. for a century, but much of the country has not acknowledged it. Noelle Evans shares what reparations could look like.
Doug George Canantillo is a survivor of a boarding school in Ontario. At school, he says students were assigned numbers, beaten for speaking their native language, and sexually abused.
The intent was to extinguish us as Aboriginal people and destroy whatever sense of self-worth we had.
Canantillo is a citizen of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, which spans the U.S.-Canada border along New York State. While Canantillo is on the Canadian side, Agnes Williams, a Haudenosaunee elder, is on the Cattaraugus Territory.
Nobody escapes from the historical trauma of the boarding schools.
Many students never returned to their families. Some were placed in foster care. Others went missing. The reverberations are still felt today. But what can be done now?
Healing doesn't happen very easily, if at all, when you're hiding behind a wall of secrecy.
That's David Simmons with the National Indian Child Welfare Association. Last year, the organization endorsed a bill that would create a federal Truth and Healing Commission. It would undo that secrecy by investigating and documenting the effects of the boarding school policy. Simmons says it would be a good start, but
I don't think just by forming a commission and having it do its reporting is going to be sufficient.
A similar commission was established in Maine in 2012. It found that Native children in the state were 5 times more likely to be placed in foster care than non-Natives, decades after the boarding school era. It's a similar trend around the country. In 2019, the Pew Research Center found that 70% of Cherokee children in the Midwest had been placed in non-Native foster homes, which can lead to a loss of identity. Of 1,700 cases, 40% were due to parental opioid abuse. Here's Simmons.
People use those destructive behaviors and those drugs as a way to cope with that pain from the trauma that they've experienced.
He says if there's going to be restitution, the intergenerational trauma must be addressed. When children were taken from their families, they didn't learn how to be parents themselves, and so that psychological injury was passed down. Simmons says specialized mental health care and parenting resources within Native communities could help, but right now there are not enough. Williams says part of this collective trauma is tied to language. When students were brutalized for speaking their native tongue, she says it caused a spiritual wound.
These languages in our cultures developed over thousands of years, and it's very meaningful for people's sense of belonging and mental health.
She says it severed their relationship with the natural world and their heritage within it, which is central to their connection with their creator. To prevent repeating this history, Williams wants people to behave in accordance with a United Nations declaration that affirms the rights of Indigenous people. For Canantillo, justice would take more than all of that.
Something deep and wonderful has been lost, and that's the terror of this thing.
He wants the remains of children who never returned from the boarding schools to be found, so that their trapped spirits can be ceremonially released into the spirit world. For NPR News, I'm Noelle Evans.
This is NPR News.
Don't. Yeah, boy. I bet you can squeal. I bet you can squeal like a pig. Oh. Well, squeal. Huh? Squeal, Ann. Squeal.
Whee!
Squeal.
Whee!
Squeal louder.
Whee!
Louder.
Whee!
Louder.
Whee!
Louder.
Whee!
Louder.
Whee!
Louder. Get down there, boy.
Louder.
Hey, them bridges down. Just there.
Whee!
You better than that, boy. You do better than that. Come on, squeal. Squeal.
Ned Beatty was a character actor best known for his appearances in the movies Deliverance, Network, and Superman. He died Sunday at age 83. NPR's Anastasia Tsiolkas has this remembrance of Beatty and his long and enduring career, a career in which he played everything from a network executive to a stuffed bear.
Born and raised in Kentucky, Ned Beatty worked in film, theater, and TV for more than four decades. He grew up singing in barbershop quartets. After his dad died when he was 15, he started working as an usher in a movie theater, and he got to watch a lot of films. His own first film role was a very memorable one. He appeared in the 1972 movie Deliverance, playing a hapless weekend warrior who is sexually assaulted in the Georgia backwoods. In a 1989 op-ed for the New York Times, Beatty said that he was very proud of having played that part. He wrote that he got angry when people shouted, "Squeal like a pig," at him when they saw him in public. Instead, he asked, what would it be like if men really grappled with sexual assault and thought deeply about living with that fear of rape? In 2003, Ned Beatty appeared as Big Daddy in a Broadway revival of Tennessee Williams' play Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. In his wide-ranging career, Beatty also played comic roles, from the bumbling henchman Otis in Superman and Superman II to the bitter Teddy, Lots of Huggin' Bear, who rules Sunnyside Daycare in Toy Story 3.
When the kids get old, new ones come in. When they get old, new ones replace them. You'll never be outgrown or neglected, never abandoned or forgotten. No owners means no heartbreak.
Beatty earned an Academy Award nomination for the 1976 film Network, in which he appears for just a few minutes as the rich, feared boss.
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale, and I won't have it! Is that clear?
In a 1987 interview on WHYY's Fresh Air, Beatty said humbly that part of the mystique of his role in Network was the build-up to his actual appearance on screen.
I must tell you, anytime you read a play or a script and they talk about your character for pages and pages and pages before you appear, that's like a license. That's like a license to steal. It's wonderful when they talk about you for a long time before you get there. That's like having been on screen all that time. And this particular character was focused on a lot by a wonderful actor named Robert Duvall, who talked about me all the time and his fear of me.
In his Fresh Air interview, Beatty said that he was very fortunate not to be typecast as a particular kind of character, but instead he was treated as an actor who could play many different roles. His long filmography and list of television credits are ample proof of that versatility. Anastasia Tsiolkas, NPR News, New York.
Since you're my special friend, come closer for a special treat. I'm going to let you touch me in a special place.
It is never okay to touch someone else's private parts. Your mom and dad will tell you so.
The leader of the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S. said today that Southern Baptists might be at the most important crossroads of a generation. The statement comes as leaders are deciding how to address sexual abuse in churches. Southern Baptist congregations are in Nashville this week for their annual meeting, and they're grappling with some newly released secret recordings. The audio was made public by a leading pastor trying to show the convention has been more concerned about preserving the core of the denomination than caring for survivors. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports.
Thousands of Southern Baptist Convention churches send delegates, known as messengers, to these annual meetings, and they vote on all sorts of proposals and position statements. This morning, Pastor Grant Gaines of Murfreesboro, Tennessee, stood at a microphone in the sea of people flanked by a church abuse survivor with tears in her eyes.
Quite frankly, SBC messengers and especially SBC abuse survivors deserve to know the truth.
Gaines and others have pushed for the denomination's leaders to widen a probe into sexual abuse and attempts to conceal those incidents. Tanya Price, who represents a church outside Lexington, Kentucky, says everyone deserves more transparency.
There are victims. There are real-life hurting people that God would never want us to abandon those people and to leave them in a situation where they continue to hurt.
But the denomination's executive committee has resisted calls for an open-ended outside investigation. The panel's leader, Ronnie Floyd, says the investigation he's authorized is sufficient. He notes the denomination has amended its constitution to allow dropping any churches that continue employing abusers. Floyd's bigger focus has been on the backbiting, though he says he welcomes scrutiny.
But individuals and groups should do so in a biblical manner. A biblical manner without attacking one another and creating suspicion about the character of one another.
Last week, another minister from Texas released audio recordings that he said show Floyd has been more concerned about preserving big church donors than hearing from victims. Floyd is seen as a more conservative leader of the already conservative denomination, and much of this discord has been with those seen as relatively more progressive, like Russell Moore, who stepped down last month. He was constantly rebuking President Trump when he was in office, even though the denomination has been closely tied to the Republican Party. It turns out that behind the scenes, his push to address abuse more publicly ruffled the most feathers. One of Moore's allies is the outgoing elected leader of the Southern Baptist Convention, J.D. Greer. He used his last sermon today as president to discourage members from acting like the religious leaders of Jesus's day.
I can assure you it happens when we care more about our reputation than the victim's safety, or when we defer to protection of the institution rather than the protection of the vulnerable for whom Jesus died.
Greer says the denomination's future is on the line. Southern Baptists are already struggling to attract their new generation. He says the convention's mishandling of hot-button issues hurts the cause. The SBC's down to 14 million members as Christian denominations of all kinds battle sliding numbers. Departures in the last year include Mena Moira of Atlanta, who served as a minister in the Southern Baptist Convention.
We didn't leave it. It left us.
Moira says he looked at his daughter and saw a church where she could still never be a pastor, or a place where his gay friends may be welcomed but uncomfortable. With the sexual assault investigation, he says Southern Baptists have an opportunity to show they want to make things right. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
Every single day I can think to do, I was really good. I was really good. I ain't want her to be fat like that. I do not want my baby to be fat like that, because I know a black man in America, you can't be like that. I try to... I was trying to tell him, you can't be like that. You can't be like that in America in a black man. I was just...
For teens struggling with severe obesity, getting that weight off and keeping it off can seem impossible. But experts and the American Academy of Pediatrics says there is an effective treatment for severe obesity in adolescents, bariatric surgery. One in five adolescents suffer with extreme weight problems, yet only a tiny fraction of them get the surgery. NPR's Yuki Nogaduchi has more.
As a child, Kayla Northam's body became a battleground. At home, she and her mother fought daily over what she should eat and how much.
Both of my parents have always struggled with their weight. My brother has struggled with his weight. It's a huge family issue.
At school, where she dreaded the gym class weigh-in.
I already knew to be ashamed of the fact that I weighed so much more than everyone else.
And in the doctor's office.
He'd be telling us, you gotta get her to diet. And this is back when I'm 5, 6 years old. But I was just always hungry. It was just never enough.
As a teen, Northam topped 300 pounds and started developing diabetes and liver and joint problems. Then she heard about something called bariatric surgery, but she knew her mother would never support it.
In her mind, it's a cheap attempt to lose weight. You know, you could do this if you just worked harder. It's a waste of time because you won't change your habits.
So Northam bided her time. Right as she turned 18 and legally an adult, she secretly met with Fatima Cody Stanford, an obesity expert at Harvard.
I remember it very clearly. It was like the day or so after her birthday, like as soon as she could get in.
That day, Stanford explained how obesity is widely misunderstood.
Obesity is a disease of the brain, and people don't recognize that. They think it's a disease of willpower.
Bariatric surgery works, she told Northam, by removing or bypassing much of the stomach, where hunger-stimulating hormones are produced. Reducing those hormones alters how the brain signals hunger. Stanford says every person's brain tries to maintain the body at a certain weight, or set point. Genetics and lifestyle can alter where the brain sets its target. But when you're struggling with obesity, that target is stuck at a high level and very difficult to lower. But surgery can retrain the brain to find a lower set point.
Bariatric surgery is the best treatment that we have anywhere in the world for severe obesity. It drastically changes set point in a way that nothing else does.
Hearing this gave Northam hope.
I jumped onto her like a life raft. I had so much hope after meeting with her.
Bariatric surgery for adolescent patients was rare until about 2 decades ago. Now, more doctors argue broader access to the treatment is necessary, especially as increasing numbers of young people suffer from severe obesity. The surgery, they say, is proving far more effective than medication or diet and exercise alone. There are risks, like vitamin deficiency or regaining the weight, but obesity experts say those are dwarfed by the potentially life-saving benefits. Mark Michalski is a pediatric surgeon at Nationwide Children's Hospital at Ohio State. He's also a researcher in a multi-year National Institutes of Health study tracking young bariatric patients. His typical patient is 15 or 16 and about 100 pounds overweight. In a large majority of cases, they have related health problems.
We're now seeing data that shows that there may be a protective effect of youth. Adolescents undergoing these operations are actually having a more robust improvement in things like diabetes and hypertension.
Sometimes within days of getting the procedure.
You're talking potentially about a lifetime of that patient not suffering from the cumulative impact of having those diseases had nothing been done in the first place.
Basically, it works better than any other treatment to date, yet it isn't offered to the vast majority of patients who might benefit. That's especially true among people of color who suffer higher rates of obesity but are less likely to be referred to treatment. Then there is also the issue of cost. Health insurers deny about half of teens' initial requests to approve the $20,000 surgery, though some state Medicaid programs sometimes will. And Fatima Stanford, the Harvard obesity doctor, says parents often think surgery to treat obesity is too extreme.
They're willing to send their kid to surgery to get their tonsils out, to do anything else. But when you start talking about obesity, which is causing often a lot of their other medical issues, there's significant resistance.
So it was for Kayla Northam, who kept her mother in the dark until just before the surgery. By then, Northam's life had become one lived on the sidelines.
I've loved playing sports my whole life. I just physically couldn't keep up with my peers. And I wanted to date. Oh my God, I was boy crazy. There was nothing I wanted more, but none of the boys wanted anything to do with me.
She was desperate for a fresh start, but surgery wasn't a quick fix. It required undergoing psychological and medical evaluations and a year and a half of nutrition classes to master an entirely new lifestyle. That was more rigorous because of her youth. Finally, she got the green light, and the effects were immediate. Within days, she lost 25 pounds.
I thought my scale was broken.
She no longer felt prisoner to hunger.
It was like, oh my God, this is what normal people feel like when they eat too much. This is my body telling me and me learning, okay, this is all I need.
In all, Northam, who is now 28, lost 150 pounds. Men flocked to her.
I all of a sudden was having people offer to buy me drinks. Luckily, I would always go out with friends who would be like, Kayla, no, you don't accept that. So in some ways, my friends had to teach me these things.
This is not uncommon, says Thomas Inge, another pioneer in the field. Inge is director of adolescent bariatric surgery at Children's Hospital of Colorado. Inge says as patients lose weight, they're often more social, and with that can come newfound exposure to drugs, alcohol, and sexually transmitted disease.
Suddenly, over the course of a very short period of time, they see these risks that they're not at all prepared for.
But again, he says, the overall mental health benefits heavily favor surgery. Kayla Northam agrees. She wishes more families would embrace bariatric surgery.
Because you have kids like I was struggling with depression, not being the person they want to be, not reaching their fullest potential.
Northam says she feels it helped her reach hers. She now works as a gastrointestinal nurse, helping others like her. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
outdoors, we knew, was a real terror of life. The threat of being outdoors surfaced frequently in those days. Every possibility of excess was curtailed with it. If somebody ate too much, he could end up outdoors. If somebody used too much coal, he could end up outdoors. People could gamble themselves outdoors, drink themselves outdoors. Sometimes, mothers put their sons outdoors, and when that happened, regardless of what the son had done, all sympathy was with him. He was outdoors, and his own flesh had done it. To be put outdoors by a landlord was one thing, unfortunate, but an aspect of life over which you had no control, since you couldn't control your income. But to be slack enough to put oneself outdoors, or heartless enough to put one's own kin outdoors, that was criminal.
As we approach Juneteenth, the date commemorating the end of slavery in the U.S., we're going to take a look next at an ongoing racial disparity.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
As we approach Juneteenth, the date commemorating the end of slavery in the U.S., we're going to take a look next at an ongoing racial disparity. Black people are twice as likely to face eviction from the homes they rent compared to white people. There's some evidence that's been the case during the pandemic, too. Meanwhile, a federal moratorium that's been protecting many families from eviction is about to expire in 2 weeks. NPR's Chris Arnold has been following this. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Ari.
You've been reporting on evictions throughout the pandemic. Are they hitting black renters harder?
That does appear to be what's happening. And I did a story recently about a nonprofit group that tracked evictions by one big corporate landlord named Pretty and Partners. And this group found that the company had filed well over 1,000 eviction cases during the pandemic. And their report looked at mostly black counties and compared them to mostly white counties, similar median incomes. And they found that this company was filing eviction cases at more than 4 times the rate against renters in those black counties versus the white counties.
4 times higher seems extraordinary. Is that typical?
It's hard to say if it's typical, but it certainly caught the attention of chair of the Senate Banking Committee, Senator Sherrod Brown. He sent a letter to the company asking for a meeting, and he wants answers about what's going on. The company says it's going to cooperate. And we should say that the company says the report is misleading and makes baseless assertions. And it says that it provides equal support to all residents.
Okay, so beyond this one company, is there a broader evidence across the country of a disparate impact on black renters?
Yes, and there absolutely is. A recent study out of the Eviction Lab at Princeton University, this one looked at millions of court records of eviction cases across 39 states over a number of years. This goes back before the pandemic. Peter Hepburn is one of the researchers who did the study.
Nationwide, on average, we're seeing eviction filing rates against black renters that are about twice as high as what we see for white renters.
And as far as why that's happening, Ari, he says there are a lot of reasons.
And some of them are just economic, right? We know that black renters have lower incomes. They have less stable employment as well. They have less in savings, and they're less able to call on family ties to provide financial support in the event of an emergency.
But Hepburn thinks, too, that sometimes landlords are just treating people differently, being quicker to file eviction cases against black renters.
You've been talking to people who are on the verge of getting evicted or who have been evicted. What are they telling you about their experiences in the pandemic?
Well, you know, some of what we just heard Hepburn talking about, right? I mean, black families historically tend to have less wealth and less savings for an emergency. So it's just harder to call mom and dad or your uncle to borrow some money. And you see that. I spoke with a man named Ivy Ross in Jacksonville, Florida, and he lost his job cleaning and detailing semi-trucks. He also had hours cut at a second job, and he and his wife fell about $5,000 behind on the rent, and they're facing eviction.
We're that couple where people come to us when they need something. We're usually the ones to help others. So it's like, in this time when the roles has changed, if they came right now today and kicked me out of this house, I ain't got nowhere to go. I'd be looking at a hotel room.
And hotel rooms, of course, are more expensive than just renting your place. So people end up falling deeper and deeper into debt a lot of the time, even living in their cars. You can just end up in this downward spiral.
But Congress approved billions of dollars in rental assistance to help people like Ivy Ross. I mean, why hasn't that come through for so many people who are in that situation?
Well, you know, that's just kind of all over the map. There are now 389 different programs trying to distribute this federal money, Ari, and some are working really well now. Some are a mess. Ivy Ross was told that it was too late for him to apply. That wasn't even true. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking and 7 million people are still behind on rent, and the CDC moratorium ends in 2 weeks.
Is there a chance the administration might extend that moratorium?
They have extended it in the past. It's not clear if they'll do that again. One argument for extending it is to give this rental assistance money and the programs more time to work. In Boston this week, I talked to a renter. She's an African-American single mom with two kids, Nancy Morozny. And she says she's never faced eviction before this. She lost work during the pandemic and she was really scared. But the program there just told her she is getting a lot of back rent paid with that federal money.
I believe it was $15,000. I was in complete shock. I was crying. I was in tears. I was so grateful. I was so excited and so happy that finally something good is happening.
And of course, she doesn't have that huge debt hanging over her head either. But, you know, in a lot of places, it's just not working this well yet. And people need more time to get the help.
That's NPR's Chris Arnold. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Ari.
Tell me who paid reparations on my soul? Who paid reparations? Because I don't dig segregation, but I can't get integration. I got to take it to the United Nations. Someone to help me away from this station. Tell me who paid reparations on my soul?
Almost every year, in his class about race and politics, Professor Tatish Nateta likes to introduce the debate over reparations with a certain comedy show sketch from the early 2000s.
And now, a News Center 3 special report with Frank Dobson and Chuck Taylor.
Good afternoon.
It's comedian Dave Chappelle. He's in a gray suit, dressed as a news anchor named Chuck Taylor.
Our top story, as we all know, Congress recently approved paying over $1 trillion to African Americans as reparations for slavery. Well, today, the first checks were sent out.
The sketch is a satire about what would happen if descendants of enslaved people actually got cash reparations.
Wendy?
Thanks, Chuck. We're standing here in front of the Olympic Liquor Store in Queens, where scores of African Americans have been lined up for hours.
The sketch depicts African Americans buying expensive cars and jewelry, which Professor Nateta says
connects with the widespread stereotype regarding ways in which African Americans are frivolous with their money.
Even though public support for cash reparations has seen an uptick in the past year, almost two-thirds of Americans oppose the idea. Professor Nateta, who teaches at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, polled Americans to find out why and what he found.
The most frequent explanation for why it is people oppose reparations are that African Americans and the descendants of slaves are undeserving of these cash payments. So it's not about cost. It's about perceptions of deservedness. And if you sort of dig deeper into this explanation, it's really about the notion that the reparation should go to actual slaves, right, based upon their experience. And there's a belief that the descendants of slaves have no real standing. They're not deserving of receiving these cash payments, these various benefits that we've seen associated with reparations.
Can I ask what the second most popular reason was?
Yeah, so the second most popular reason is that it's impossible to place a monetary value on the impact of slavery. And when we look at the breakdown of those who opposed reparations and then selected this explanation, it tended to be progressives, young people, Democrats, and Biden voters. So in explaining the popularity of this explanation for opposing reparations, in some ways, it's individuals who may be allies of those who support reparations, but recognize that any payment that is provided for the legacy of slavery would not be enough.
I want to think about this also in the context of just U.S. policy when it comes to giving cash payments in general. in a way, we're in the middle of that experiment with like COVID payments, right?
We are in this really interesting experiment as to what happens when the federal government, in this case, provides to a widespread population of individuals cash payments, right? So we have that from the stimulus payments. And the interesting thing that's happening, if you look at what people are using this money for, they tend to be using the money to pay their rent, to pay down their debt, at some points in time to buy new things, but those purchases are fueling the economy. And so we are in a moment here, and I think if proponents of reparations are really focused on trying to spread this policy across the country, to use this moment in time to demonstrate that African Americans and Americans more generally, when they receive cash payments, tend to act in the ways in which most people would not assume, right? That would counter our stereotypes.
But you do hear some backlash in the form of, let's say, a Republican argument that is saying, look, people aren't motivated to find work because they're getting cash from the government. I mean, there is still this idea that this doesn't work the way the proponents of it say it will.
Yeah, you're right. Of course, there's going to be backlash against the provision of cash payments, likely by conservatives and Republicans, given their ideological attachments. But the evidence demonstrates that individuals, when they receive these cash payments, particularly individuals at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, are using this money to address some of the financial issues that they have faced over the course of this year. But at the same time, you know, this argument regarding the lack of motivation, the lack of work of individuals when they receive cash payments, I mean, there's another way to look at this issue. It may not necessarily be that the provision of cash payments leads these folks to not work. It may be that the jobs that are not being filled are not paying enough. And as a country, we should start potentially looking at the level of payment for these jobs, these blue collar jobs that are not being filled.
So where does that leave the U.S. in terms of this discussion? I mean, now that you've looked at these numbers, do you see a path forward where this movement continues or not?
Yeah, I think we're seeing the beginnings of this reparations movement. It's just not occurring at the national level. So we live in a federalist system, and one of the benefits of a federalist system is that each locality, each city, each state is an experiment in democracy. And we're finding that in places like Evanston and Iowa City and Asheville, North Carolina, and here in my backyard of Amherst, Massachusetts, that local communities are beginning to not only discuss reparations for their African-American neighbors and constituents, but are actually passing policies, innovative policies, policies which take the revenue from the sale of marijuana and create these housing reparations programs that we see in Evanston. We're seeing in places like San Francisco, real discussions about the legacy of discrimination, the legacy of racism that has shaped the contours and the demographics of that city, and a real discussion about how that community is going to deal with this legacy and, again, make the African-American community there whole. So I think we're seeing it at the local level. The question is whether or not that will spread to more conservative cities and then potentially to the nation as a whole.
That's Tatish Netetta, political science professor at UMass Amherst. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you for having me.
The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell. Hi-ho the derry-o, the farmer in the dell.
Now, last week on the show, we spoke about the decades of discrimination that Black farmers and other farmers of color have experienced in the U.S. The exclusionary policies of the federal government are one important factor that contributed to Black farmers losing 12 million acres of land over the past century. These discriminatory policies are hardly a thing of the past. For example, Black farmers received just 0.1% of the relief funds allocated to farmers under the Trump administration's COVID-19 stimulus packages. And the American Rescue Plan, passed in March, was supposed to finally begin to address these inequalities by offering meaningful debt relief to Black farmers and other farmers of color.
When we checked in last week, the plan was finally scheduled to get underway. Until Thursday, when a federal judge placed a temporary restraining order on the program, and the judge sided with a group of white farmers who claimed the debt relief policy discriminates against them. Here's what Lloyd Wright, a farmer and the former director of the USDA Civil Rights Office, told me last week about these types of lawsuits.
For the last 150 years, white farmers have received almost all of the benefits from the Department of Agriculture. And now that we're getting ready to give crumbs to some extent to people of color, American Indians, who they took the land from to begin with, and blacks who cleared the land as slaves for them back generations ago. So now that they're getting ready to give crumbs to minorities, they have ants in their pants. They didn't get concerned 4 years ago when the Trump administration did emergency payments to farmers, and 99%+ of it went to white farmers. I didn't hear about lawsuits then concerned that people of color was not getting money.
Meanwhile, the USDA says that it is defending the debt relief plan despite the temporary hold, and that it plans to continue paying off loans for black farmers if and when the hold is lifted. For more, I am joined now by Congresswoman Alma Adams, who represents the extraordinary North Carolina 12th District. Representative Adams is also vice chair of the House Committee on Agriculture. Representative Adams, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa. It's good to be with you.
So we had just done this story with Farmer Wright when I then saw the news that the debt relief was being put on hold. I was so hurt and angry. What was your initial reaction to learning this news?
Well, Melissa, I was just devastated. I disagree with the judge's order, but I'm disappointed in the people who brought this misguided lawsuit as well. These borrowers were scheduled to receive the assistance as early as this month. And so this decision is going to delay the recovery for these farmers. And they've suffered and they continue to suffer. And we just need to stay on top of this.
So if you had an opportunity to talk with these plaintiffs, with these white farmers, with the conservative groups who are defending them in court, what might you say to them about this set-aside relief for farmers of color?
Well, first of all, I would talk to them about all of the past discrimination. The fact that, these are farmers who are working to make sure that they provide for their families, to make sure that they're able to stay in business. And I think I would try to at least appeal to whatever sensitivity they have. But I think it's important that we recap the history for people who don't seem to want to recognize it and just kind of put it up in their faces. The discrimination is something that I think we try to ignore. And we've seen it not just with this situation, but with the distribution of funds for historically black colleges and so forth. And we've got 1890s that actually deal with agriculture in terms of their programs. So I think we have to make it very clear that we have not gotten, not even our fair share. We just have not been treated, these farmers have just not been treated fairly. And we should be able to appeal to some sensitivity of these white farmers.
The 1890s institutions, those historically black land grant colleges, and North Carolina A&T is among them that's in your district. Talk about the history of agriculture associated also with black education.
Well, thank you, Melissa. And let me just say North Carolina A&T is my alma mater twice. I have been very involved with doing work for our historically black colleges and universities, and we have 19 1890s. And just as we started HBCUs many years ago because our students that looked like me and you could not attend the major majority culture schools. So in North Carolina, we have North Carolina A&T, which is an 1890 land grant. There's an 1862 North Carolina State. And we've seen discrimination throughout this process of funding for these schools. They are very much involved with not only doing research, but we have worked through the Agriculture Committee to try to get increased support. As a matter of fact, just recently we did have a hearing on 18 black farmers, and they talked a lot about not only the schools and so forth, but I think that we're going to have to continue. Right now, what we see is that the state is required to match the funding from the federal government to our schools, and that has not been done. Historically, that has not been done. I served 20 years in the North Carolina House, and it seems that we just couldn't find the funding for North Carolina A&T that was a 1-1 match, but yet we're able to match money to North Carolina State 5 and 6 times. So that means to me that it's not a lack of funding, it's a lack of where we put our priorities. And so we've not put the priorities in terms of state government supporting our 1890s. But these schools are valuable, they're important. We are losing black farmers day by day. The number is diminishing. And so we want to keep young people interested in agribusiness and agriculture overall. And that one of the ways to do it is to make sure that we have the funding there to provide scholarships. And the gentleman is right. You can't just give them money today and say, let's produce tomorrow. I mean, we've got to be realistic about it and make sure that the ample time is provided to do all those things that they need to do.
I so appreciate you making that connection, and also that those inequities, not only in what we think of as payments directly to farmers, but to that whole system of college education also associated with those land grants, how many years of inequalities there are. I'm wondering, we also heard from Mr. Wright talking about the possibility of restructuring aspects of the USDA. Given that you are sitting there in a leadership role on the Ag Committee within Congress, is that something that you all have any capacity or power to do?
Oh, yes, we do. We provide oversight to USDA. I've always believed in making sure that we bring the stakeholders to the table, because folks like Mr. Wright, they're out here where the rubber meets the road. They're working day by day, and they're the ones who I think realistically can provide information to us that's helpful. It is clear that we do handle the oversight, and including North Carolina A&T. And we've got to make sure that we take the advice of people who actually know this business. And yes, restructuring, you know, you can't keep things as they are just because these particular things have been in existence for many, many years. And just because, you always have to go back and revisit and revise. And especially if things aren't working, and certainly they've not been working for our black farmers. So yeah, I would support that. And I think, again, we probably need to have a follow-up hearing and have some discussion about it. But we don't have to just have a hearing to discuss it. But I do think, we have the oversight, and there are many things I think that we can do in terms of holding folks accountable, putting pressure where pressure needs to be put.
Now, I wanted to also just ask you briefly about the legal argument here, because after the American Rescue Plan was passed back in March, you actually cited a 1995 Supreme Court decision and defended the ability of Congress to act on the basis of race to remedy these effects of discrimination. Can you walk us through that just a bit here?
Well, I think race is something that people don't want to talk about as much, but there's a lot going on that shouldn't be. And again, I think we have to, historically, the discrimination has existed. It's still there. The inequities are present. When the lawsuit the ruling poses a question: how are we going to rectify these decades of discrimination and inequities when the law justified that discrimination, but they won't actively work to correct it? And I think we have to hold them accountable to do that. And that's where I think the Congress can come into play here. We've got a lot of work to do. And I think we, you know, we can't let up and just let this continue to go, because we'll never get the problem corrected. But I think with all of the discussion that we're having today, with so many things going on, we're going to have to, race has got to be a part of it. People don't need to get upset and angry about it. It is real. And we have to be realistic about it and try to understand it more. And that's where I think the education is going to have to come into play.
Congresswoman Alma Adams represents North Carolina's 12th congressional district. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa. You keep up the good work. Mama, I got dreams.
Brother, I heard y'all ain't hitting in New York.
Word.
I heard y'all ain't hitting in L.A.
Word. Word.
I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Next, we hear two voices behind a story at the University of North Carolina. The university hired an acclaimed New York Times journalist. She was the driving force behind the Times 1619 project that argued slavery is central to the American story. But then the University Board of Governors did not take up a proposal to give her tenure, which triggered familiar debates about race and cancel culture. Behind that is a story about two approaches to journalism. Here's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik.
Let's meet the two people at the heart of this controversy.
My name is Walter Hussman, Jr. I'm the publisher of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and I'm 74 years old.
My name is Nicole Hannah-Jones. I am a reporter at the New York Times, and I am 45 years old.
Both earned degrees from UNC's Journalism School. Hussman was graduated in 1968. Hannah Jones received her master's in 2003. They took very different paths to get there.
Our family's been in the newspaper business since 1909, and my grandfather started the business, and my father did it for 50 years before he retired. And so I always thought I might want to go into journalism.
In high school, I complained to one of the only black male teachers I ever had that our high school newspaper never seemed to write about kids like me, which almost all of the black kids were bused into a school that didn't really feel like ours. And he suggested I should write that story myself, or don't complain to him anymore, that I needed to join the newspaper staff. So I did.
Hannah Jones has won praise for her investigations into ongoing racial segregation, but she's perhaps best known for being the force behind the 1619 Project. In that series, the New York Times explored the sordid and central role slavery played in U.S. history and in the prosperity of white America. It was acclaimed. She won a Pulitzer in the commentary division for it. It was also attacked. For example, some scholars say it overstated the role of slavery in inspiring the American Revolution. And here's where Hannah Jones collides with Hussman.
I'm worried that we're moving away from those time-tested principles of journalism that we had in the 20th century that were so effective at engendering tremendous trust in the media.
Hussman's papers lean to the right on the editorial pages, but he says he wants clear separation from the news pages, where he mandates what's often called impartiality or objectivity. Reporters must avoid any bias or position or belief in pursuit of the facts and give people the chance to make up their own minds. A few years back, Hussman made a $25 million pledge to the school. His journalistic manifesto, and it is broader than just objectivity, has been painted on a banner at the school. It's now the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media, and Hannah Jones is up for that tenured job there. Hussman opposes her bid.
I've been in the news business, the newspaper business, for 50 years, and so many times we start out on a story. Now, we may have a couple of leads, a couple of tips, and things seem pretty rational. And we think we know what the truth is on the front end. And as we dig into it, we find it's something very different. And, you know, then we have to follow the story wherever it leads.
Hannah Jones backs some of his priorities. That ideal of objectivity, though, Hannah Jones says, it's loaded.
We are both graduates of that journalism school. We are both people who have been in the newspaper industry for a very long time. And no one person gets to establish the rules of our trade.
Hannah Jones asks, why shouldn't reporters care if local governments fail foster kids or school children? Why do all newspapers have police reporters, but many of them don't cover poverty? These, she says, are choices. And so is the question of what sources to consider reliable. Think about how news organizations rely on police for authoritative information. Yet, without eyewitness videos, no one would have known how Eric Garner, Walter Scott, George Floyd, and so many others died.
The harm is, by pretending that the news we see is being led by objective arbiters of fact, it's just not based in reality. And I could give you 1,000 examples from the perspective of communities of color, of marginalized communities, where what we're told is objective news is not.
That, she says, is how journalism used to be taught and how it used to operate.
When you see Black reporters, people presume they see our biases. White journalists, though, are often treated as neutral, as if they're not going through the world in a racialized way or a genderized way, as if their class, status, and upbringing is not shaping their stories. But they are.
The school has offered Hannah Jones a 5-year contract, and it's asking the UNC board to reconsider her tenure bid. Most of the heat centers on the 1619 project. Hussman says that's what trips him up, too.
Sometimes controversies can overshadow or even overwhelm the core mission of any institution.
Hussman says he knows the school gets to make its own choices. UNC's journalism dean is Susan King. She sometimes wears a baseball cap emblazoned with Hussman's catchphrases about journalism. She also tells NPR the profession is changing with the times. And she says it needs to. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
From imprisoned nation.
Across the country, a number of prosecutors are working to overturn wrongful convictions, helping to free the very people their offices convicted in the past, aiming to right historical injustices. But as John Yang reports, a battle in Missouri between a progressive prosecutor and a conservative state attorney general has left one man's quest for freedom in limbo.
Hi, Mr. Johnson. For nearly 26 years, Lamar Johnson's been serving life without the possibility of parole for a murder he says he didn't commit.
For the most part, prison is just constant fear, especially when you first come in, it's afraid of how it is and what's going to happen to you. Then it's just fear of, you know, dying in prison, fear of getting sick in prison, fear of being abandoned. In my case, fear of just not having the opportunity to be heard.
Now 47 years old, Johnson was only 21 when he was locked up. For decades, he fought his conviction without the help of a lawyer.
I've not even had a hearing on any of the evidence that I have presented, and I don't understand why.
The truth of the matter is that it's very easy to get a wrongful conviction. It's incredibly difficult to overturn one.
Today, Lindsay Runnels and the Midwest Innocence Project represent Johnson. Reynolds spoke to us at the scene of the crime in question, the October 30th, 1994 murder of Marcus Boyd, a friend of Johnson's. According to court papers, Boyd was selling crack cocaine to a friend.
So, Lindsay, set the scene for us. It was at night, from what I can tell, about 9 o'clock at night.
That's right. Not much light. There's this overhead street light here. But it was dark, 9 o'clock in the fall. They're sitting on the porch and two fully masked black males dressed in all black clothing came around from behind the house through the alleys here, ran up onto the porch and grabbed Marcus.
There was a struggle and Marcus Boyd was fatally shot.
And where was Lamar?
He was about 3.5 miles from here.
And how do we know he was there?
He was there with his girlfriend who testified at trial and two other people.
At Johnson's trial, his girlfriend said he left the house for less than 5 minutes to meet a friend, which turned out to be a drug deal. Police testified he could have left and killed Boyd in no more than 5 minutes. But look at a Google map showing the route between the two locations. It takes about double that to go just one way. And police said the other man on the porch identified Johnson, despite the fact that he said it was dark and that both attackers hid their faces.
They wore ski masks that had a cutout for the eye area and portions of the nose.
So that's all that was visible?
That's correct.
Just the eyes and a little bit of the nose?
Right.
What's more, since Johnson's conviction, two men have confessed to being the ones who killed Boyd and said Johnson had nothing to do with it.
it shows that sometimes there is a miscarriage of justice.
In 2018, Johnson found an unexpected ally in St. Louis Circuit Attorney Kimberly Gardner, the current head of the very office that put him away.
I believe that because I'm a minister of justice and because I uncovered wrongdoing in this case, it is my obligation under the Constitution, not just the state, but the U.S. Constitution, to correct a wrongful conviction. And that's what I did.
His case is extremely old.
Gardner began to re-examine Johnson's case through her newly created Conviction Integrity Unit, a tool progressive prosecutors are increasingly using to prevent, identify, and undo wrongful convictions.
A Conviction Integrity Unit, in my mind, is not only to correct wrongful convictions, it's actually to teach prosecutors, police, to be a training tool to actually help us do a better job. We have to train our attorneys that in the end of the day, we're ministers of justice, to pursue justice, not merely convictions.
According to a national database, last year there were 74 conviction integrity units operating in the United States, 8 of them newly opened. Together, they were responsible for nearly half of the country's 129 exonerations. Gardner's investigation turned up even more proof of Johnson's innocence. The prosecution eyewitness recanted, admitting he'd only identified Johnson because police told him Johnson was guilty. And her team found records showing prosecutors paid that witness more than $4,000 for housing and expenses, information that was never disclosed to the defense.
So you have no evidence that he committed the crime. You have the confession of two other people that they committed the crime and that he did not. You've raised pretty good questions about whether or not the trial was fair. People will ask, then why is he in prison?
That's a good question. I mean, that's a good question.
In 2019, armed with her new evidence, Gardner went to court to ask for a new trial. For Johnson, having the top St. Louis prosecutor on his side was powerful.
I knew the Innocence Project believed me that three different directors, all types of law students, all type of law professors, everybody looked at the case and they all said the same thing. But she represented the state. And the first time that somebody from the other side had acknowledged the same thing.
But it wasn't enough. A judge threw out Gardner's request for a new trial.
Many say this case has become less about Lamar Johnson and the evidence of his innocence, and more about a struggle between a conservative state attorney general and a progressive prosecutor.
Hands up!
No shoot!
In the wake of the death of Michael Brown in nearby Ferguson and the protests and unrest that followed, Gardner was elected in 2016 on a pledge to shake up the St. Louis criminal justice system. She's done that, but it hasn't made her very popular with the political establishment. When Gardner asked for a new trial for Johnson, the judge took the unusual step of appointing State Attorney General Eric Schmidt, a Republican, to intervene. Schmidt argued that the law doesn't give Gardner the power to ask for a new trial, despite the fact that in 2018, another Missouri prosecutor was allowed to set aside two convictions in his district based on new evidence.
The Attorney General never questioned whether Lamar Johnson was innocent or there was any evidence that Lamar Johnson committed the crime. What he talked about was whether the prosecutor, like myself, had the ability to actually correct wrongful convictions. And that's a problem because you have a duty, and your duty is to protect everyone, even people who are incarcerated.
The judge and later the state Supreme Court agreed with Schmidt. For Johnson, who thought he had a breakthrough when he got the backing of Gardner's Conviction Integrity Unit, it was a heavy blow.
I was just sure that they was going to at least grant me a hearing. And when they said no, it was devastating.
So this is my dad, this is me, and this is my grandma May.
That was true for Johnson's family, too. Daughter Kiera Barrow was just an infant when he was locked up. Despite a lifetime apart, she and her father have grown close.
All the hope that you had is just quickly snatched from you. It's frustrating, because the conversation is not whether or not he's innocent, but who has the power and the authority to release him.
Gardner says this was about politics.
If I was part of the status quo club of prosecutors, I believe Lamar Johnson would be home yesterday. And I am sorry for that.
Schmidt's office never responded to multiple requests from the NewsHour for comment. Since the state Supreme Court decision, one legal hurdle to a new trial for Johnson could soon be removed. Last month, the Missouri legislature passed a new bill explicitly allowing local prosecutors to ask for the convictions of those wrongly imprisoned to be set aside. It's on Governor Mike Parson's desk, awaiting his decision. Attorney General Schmidt, now running for the U.S. Senate, could still object, and a judge would still have the final say. Meanwhile, Johnson's attorneys have a plan of their own. Ask the courts to release him because his constitutional rights were violated at trial.
But that is a hard process. There's a lot of things that have to happen before he gets that day in court, as we say. There'll be objection if passed is any indication of the future. I assume that the Attorney General's office will object to Lamar Johnson getting a hearing.
My concern is just simply getting caught up for God knows how long over procedural matters, procedural technicalities. I mean, if truth matters, if justice is what really is important, why can't we just get to that?
Johnson says he remains hopeful that one day he'll be free.
From the beginning, I knew something was wrong because I got convicted for something I didn't do. And so I knew the truth was out there somehow, and I just didn't give up. And knowing that kept me hopeful. Like, as long as there's life, there's hope. And so as long as there's hope, I know that, you know, this situation can be righted.
Even when that hope is dashed again and again by a system that seems stacked against him. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang in Jefferson City, Missouri.
Oh, they will rape you in jail, boy. See, the whole damn country is so damn conservative now. Everybody's like, jails ain't tough enough. Jails ain't tough enough. We gotta have a death penalty. Jails ain't tough enough.
Two Illinois prison guards are scheduled to go on trial later this month on federal charges they beat a prisoner to death. A third guard has already pleaded guilty. But an investigation by WBEZ has found that long before Larry Ervin was allegedly beaten to death at the Western Illinois Correctional Center, there were signs of trouble. People accusing the same guards of severely beating them in a spot in the prison that had no cameras. WBEZ's Shannon Heffernan joins us to tell us more. Hi, Shannon.
Hello.
So let's find out what happened to the person who died. Tell us a bit about Larry Ervin.
Larry Ervin allegedly was beaten in a blind spot near the entrance to segregation. That's a portion of the prison that prisoners go to when they're in trouble. He had 15 broken ribs and a punctured colon. We got video from that day. It shows Larry Ervin being transported from the housing unit to segregation. He's walked, bent over, with his hands in the air. He seems to be having trouble walking. At one point, his pants fall around his ankles and the guards throw them into the grass. Then he goes into segregation, the blind spot we've been hearing about. The next video shows him on a stretcher, presumably going to the hospital. He later died. His cause of death was listed as blunt force trauma after an altercation with staff.
So Larry Ervin, though, was not an isolated incident. Your investigation found there were more cases where people said they were beaten in or near the entrance to segregation, and there's no video coverage. What did you find?
Well, one of the stories that really sticks out to me is the story of Roger Latimer. He said he was beaten in the same location where Larry Ervin was allegedly beaten. And what stuck out to me was his story of going to the hospital. His medical records show he had 4 broken ribs and a concussion. And the nurse wrote into his medical report that Roger Latimer was trying to make a police report. But guards stopped him and said if he kept talking about making a police report, they were going to take him back to the prison. The nurse also wrote that she tried to take pictures of his injuries, but guards stopped her. The prison did open an investigation into allegations of abuse from Roger Latimer, but they never finished the investigation. The investigator later said that he was overwhelmed with other cases. We found 8 other cases similar to Larry Ervin and Roger Latimer, where prisoners say they were beat in similar locations by some of the same guards while they were being transported to segregation and in handcuffs. even some of the odd details reoccur, like the detail of the pants falling down around the ankles and being taken off by guards reoccur in some of these cases. Some of the injuries were like scratches and bruises, but some of them were really serious.
And you found evidence as well that prison officials knew there was a problem with abuse in areas that don't have cameras.
That's right. In one court filing, a warden told law enforcement that staff knew there were limited cameras in segregation. Another filing says one of the officers accused in Irvin's death told investigators everyone knew about that limited coverage and that, quote, it's institutional practice at Western Illinois Correctional Center not to report excessive force committed by its officers. But one thing that stuck out to me most was a prison record that showed another staff member said she was cornered by a guard and told to keep out of what was happening in segregation after she raised concerns.
Shannon, how has the Illinois Department of Corrections responded to what you found?
So they told us that they were taking a number of actions, like they had installed 79 new cameras at Western Illinois Correctional Center, including in the alleged blind spot. And they said they launched an immediate investigation into the Irvin incident. But they want to answer many of our basic questions about abuse and cover-ups and what appears to be a failed system of oversight. The Department of Corrections is in charge of life and death situations. And I have to say, frankly, as a journalist, I'm very concerned that they won't speak more publicly about these issues.
WBEZ's Shannon Heffernan, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
So, you know, these events that keep coming up, instead of just reacting, dealing with it one at a time and being shocked each time we have another event that surfaces that is brought to our attention, we need to function from the position of an analysis that clarifies we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that is why we are seeing the kinds of behaviors from individuals, be it Donald Sterling or be it George Zimmerman or any of the other cases that come to our attention. There is a reason that these cases exist. And I want to also talk about, in this case, they talked about mental health, but also gun control. And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious, the answer, the response to the quite collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
And it's probably not surprising for you to learn that gun theft is a significant problem in this country. It is hard to determine exactly how many weapons are boosted each year, but at least one report from the FBI estimates 1.8 million firearms were stolen from individuals between the years 2012 and 2017. And the ATF estimates approximately 54,000 more were stolen from gun stores during that time period. It's a serious problem, and one that has prompted news you can use, local reporting, like this segment from CBS 46 in Atlanta last week.
There is a way to make sure a criminal doesn't end up with your gun. Don't leave it in your car.
If your firearm absolutely has to be inside of your vehicle, you want to invest in a lockbox or a safe. Tie it to the trunk, but do not leave a firearm inside your vehicle.
Okay, I'm not really sure what's going on with the morning commute in Atlanta that makes it absolutely necessary to keep a firearm in your car, but okay. Now, that said, there is one place where it indisputably makes sense for us to keep weapons. Military bases. Marines have a pile of Colt 9mm? Cool. Navy has a room full of M16s. Seems fine. Marine locker with a M4 semi-automatic? Do you, son. The presence of heavy armaments is core to the very definition of the armed services, but what is surprising to learn is that the U.S. military may need a little refresher on gun safety, PSA style. Here's our old friend, McGruff the Crime Dog, back in 2014.
Never let your gun get into the wrong hands. If you own a firearm and are not using it, please be responsible and be sure that it's stored in a safe place.
It is, in fact, reasonable to assume military custody is a safe place for weapons. But a new investigation from the Associated Press found that around 1,900 military weapons were either lost or stolen during the past decade. That number includes more than 1,100 rifles, 694 handguns, 74 machine guns, and 34 rocket launchers. And once they're lost or stolen, these military weapons often resurface in places as close as Albany, New York, or as far away as Afghanistan, sometimes being used to commit violent crimes. With 34 missing rocket launchers, I'm thinking we're going to need more than McGruff the crime dog. Joining me now, hopefully with the coordinates of these missing rocket launchers, is Kristen Hall, a reporter at the Associated Press and one of the journalists who broke the story. Kristen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So this is the first public accounting of its kind in decades. How did you and your team go about investigating this?
Well, it was very difficult, and it took us years to do. One reason for that is that the DOD and the military are not required to publicly report this information. That was the case at one point back in the early 90s, as we understand, they were required to report equipment losses to Congress on an annual basis. But when that requirement stopped, public accountability slipped. But that doesn't mean that, you know, incidents and losses didn't keep happening.
So when you all have found it through this difficult multi-year process that 1,900 U.S. military firearms were lost or stolen, are you confident that's the maximum number, or are you thinking that's probably an undercount?
We know that it's an undercount for a number of reasons. For instance, the Air Force gave us no data on how many firearms they have lost or have been stolen. The Army gave the AP a very clear undercount of data that didn't include things like major cases, open cases. And so the AP found internal memos that the Army produced that showed their count of weapons loss was many times higher than what they told the AP.
So what kinds of weapons are most likely to go missing?
Well, I mean, they're the workhorse weapons of the U.S. military. So they're rifles and pistols. These are, you know, they have several million weapons all across the globe. And a lot of these fit into those two categories.
Now, are people within the military themselves taking these? How are they getting out? How are they going missing?
Well, there's sometimes where we understand that insiders, people who work and have access to armories, warehouses, have been accused of taking weapons and weapons parts off post. Maybe they're selling them. Maybe they're making a new weapon out of weapons parts. But a lot of times it's unclear what happens. Records are destroyed, inventories are not taken in a proper way, and investigators are reaching dead ends.
So I suppose if all these weapons ended up in the same place that the left sock ends up after laundry, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But that's not what's happening, right? Where do these weapons end up?
Yeah, it is hard to trace where some of these weapons end up, but we have found a small number that ended up in violent crimes. For instance, we found a military pistol that was tied to four separate shootings in Albany, New York. What's interesting is that when police recovered this Beretta M9, the Army didn't even know that the gun was missing from Fort Bragg.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is just stunning to me. I, you know, living in North Carolina, not that far from Fort Bragg, having, you know, friends and family in military, it's always been my experience that, you know, soldiers and Navy folks and Marines, they are serious about weapon safety. This is truly a shocking story to me.
Yeah, I mean, certainly weapons security is drilled into troops from the moment they get into the service. And top military officials say, you know, that it is a very high priority for them to take care of their weapons. You know, but we just found some cases where, you know, troops were sleeping on the job. There's shoddy record keeping, just it's a surveillance camera system that didn't work. And just security lapses.
So if there is meant to be an accountability space, where should the buck stop? Is it with those troops, often young men and women? If they're literally sleeping on the job, it might suggest something about their exhaustion. Or is there someone in the Pentagon who we ought to be holding accountable?
Well, I think transparency would help here in this situation. And, you know, we have seen actually the reaction from Congress to this story was immediate. On Tuesday, Army Secretary Christine Wormuth was asked about whether she would be open to new oversight on weapons accountability. So I do think that having more information about how these cases occur could help solve some of the problems.
So speaking of solving some of the problems, does the military ever recover weapons that have been lost? Or once they're gone, are they just sort of gone forever?
No, they do recover. I mean, in the case of the Navy and Marines, they gave us good information and that included recoveries. So, you know, and a lot of times a gun will go missing and it will immediately be found, you know, within, 24 hours. But sometimes things go missing for several years.
Okay, so let's dig into that for just a second, because I do actually get, I mean, I'm disturbed by, but I can get how a handgun might go missing. But for real, grenade and rocket launchers? Now, I know that these are vanishingly small numbers, right? 34, 35 over the course of a decade. But still, I mean, you don't like accidentally leave your rocket launcher, you know, like upstairs beside your bed. Where are the rocket launchers?
That's a good question. I don't know about that. I wish I did. Someone knows where they are.
Yeah, I really would like some. I mean, you know, I'm sorry. I am not an alarmist, and I try very hard not to be an alarmist. But I will say that that kind of got to me in a particular way. And I suppose it shouldn't, because we do know that handguns are actually, you know, the most sort of deadly weaponry for civilians. So can you talk to me about how this story of military loss of weapons is connected to sort of our broader guns conversation in this country?
Well, we're certainly not suggesting that the military's lost firearms are somehow contributing to an increase in gun violence. That's not what we're saying in this story. What we are saying is that a gun that belongs to the military can end up in the hand of felons, and we found several cases of that. So they can be used in crimes. These are weapons sometimes that civilians aren't meant to have. And when they're stolen, when they're taken from somewhere, when they're military property, you know, the people that are using them or want them or buy them are not on the up and up. I mean, we found a case in Fresno, California, where AK-74s were sold to a Fresno street gang. And several of those have not been recovered.
Talk to me also about how this might be not so much about guns, but also about reporting. So part of what I appreciate about what you said in this story is that it took years. It was you and colleagues doing this work. That is a fairly substantial investment of journalistic work, labor hours, to get government accountability, right? It is in certain ways the thing that American media was meant to be in our democracy. And that's happening at the same time that, for example, local papers are closing, and it's harder and harder to get exactly those kinds of reporting resources. Is there something about this story that also helps us understand the stories we may not even realize we're missing because of that sort of loss of reporting resources?
Well, I mean, I certainly, over the years that I was looking at this story or looking at this idea and trying to ask questions of the Army, you know, I got told no several times. You know, we're not going to give you that information. We're not going to give you these records. You know, I mean, that is frustrating. And there is a sense of like, oh, I'm just going to move on, you know. But I mean, to me, there's just a curiosity factor. You know, I was seeing these cases of troops getting arrested and stealing things. And I just, you know, knew that somebody had the answers. There's information. I mean, the military counts a lot of things, has a lot of things to count. So, you know, I think there's just a persistence there of saying, no, there is numbers. There are numbers that you can provide. And to me, I think there is there's a accountability to the public that needs to happen, because these weapons are not meant to be put on the streets or used in street crimes. They're meant to protect us.
Hmm. Kristen Hall, I so appreciate that response. In many ways, it is journalism 101. I was curious, I was consistent, and I knew that data was out there, so I kept going until I got it. Kristen Hall is a reporter, and a good one, at the Associated Press. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
A Canadian man accused of killing four members of a Muslim family in Ontario last week is now charged with terrorism. Police say the 20-year-old carried out a premeditated attack because of his victim's religion. Reporter Emma Jacobs has more from Quebec City.
Canada's Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland reacted to the charges in a news conference on Monday, approving of the decision to designate the attack as terrorism.
It is important for us to identify the terrible threat that white supremacism poses to Canada and to Canadians.
Canadians took part in observances across the country over the past week in honor of the family killed in the attack in London, Ontario. For many, the events brought back memories of an earlier tragedy. In 2017, a man opened fire in a mosque in Quebec City, killing six worshippers and injuring five. Several hundred people gathered outside that Quebec City mosque for a vigil on Friday evening.
Assalamu alaikum. Bonsoir à tout le monde.
Ayman Derbali was paralyzed trying to disarm the gunman in the 2017 attack and now uses a wheelchair. He thanked those who came to honor the family killed in London. Below him was a portrait of the victims, Madiha Salman, her husband Salman Afzal, Afzal's mother, and the couple's 15-year-old daughter Yumna, were out for a walk when a 20-year-old Canadian man ran a pickup truck onto the curb. The couple's 9-year-old son, Fayez, survived. Derbali said, personally, since hearing the news, I've been feeling very badly. It's made me relive everything we went through. Like the U.S., Canada is contending with a surge in right-wing radicalization, which at times has turned violent. Last year in Toronto, a man with alleged neo-Nazi ties was charged with murdering the caretaker of a mosque. An attendee at the vigil in Quebec City, Ziad Khalel, said that they wanted to express solidarity with the community targeted in London.
We are with you. We are feeling what you are feeling because we went through all what you're going through right now.
Khalel lost friends in the 2017 shooting.
That's why I'm feeling all this anger and all this sadness these days.
Another attendee, a woman named Salwa Haji, says that the latest attack also intensified fear she's felt since the Quebec City attack. Haji is wearing a navy blue headscarf. She works as a nurse and says her shifts finish late at night. On my way home in winter, she says, I hide under the hood of my coat so that people can't see that I'm Muslim. But during the summer, there's nothing I can do. She says she tries not to transmit her fear to her husband or kids. At a vigil in Montreal the same evening, Quebec's minister for fighting racism was heckled over a provincial law barring many public employees, including teachers, from wearing religious symbols. It's seen by many as targeting Muslim women who wear headscarves. Debate over the bill intensified nationally over the past week. After the vigil in Quebec City, another survivor of the 2017 mosque attack, Larbi Yaya, says he still feels welcome in Quebec, but that changes are needed at all levels, including in schools.
To bring this living together message, because we have to fight against ignorance. It's the ignorance that brings all this hatred. We don't know each other.
Yaya says he lost his best friend in the shooting 4 years ago. Two other survivors of that attack traveled to Ontario to offer condolences to the family of last week's victims, who were laid to rest on Saturday. For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs in Quebec City. Now I really understand what they mean when they say white power, white blue, yeah. Come on, white blue,
white blue, it's white blue, white blue. All right. The White House published its framework today for how it intends to combat one of the most pressing national security threats, domestic terrorism. It comes nearly 6 months after pro-Trump rioters overwhelmed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Amna Nawaz reports.
That's right, Judy. It was President Biden's Attorney General, Merrick Garland, who spoke before cameras today to roll out this 32-page strategy. Here's what he said.
During President Biden's first week in office, he directed the administration to undertake an assessment of the domestic terrorism threat and then to use that assessment to develop the national strategy being released today. In March, they concluded that domestic violent extremists pose an elevated threat to the homeland in 2021. In the FBI's view, the top domestic violent extremist threat comes from racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, specifically those who advocate for the superiority of the white race.
Now, the strategy outlines a whole-of-government approach to the problem. It calls for better information sharing among the many agencies that are involved, calls for a broader push to short-circuit the ability of domestic extremist groups to recruit new members online, and improved screening to root out extremism within the U.S. military and law enforcement. Mary McCord previously served as the top national security official in the Justice Department. She studies and writes about these issues at Georgetown University, and she joins me now. Mary McCord, welcome back to the NewsHour. When you look at this strategy, what does it say, the size and the scope of it? What does it say to you about how this administration views domestic terrorism in 2021?
Well, I think it serves an important signaling function. First, that this administration recognizes the threat from domestic extremist violence and domestic terrorism. And that is something that has not really been seriously recognized in the previous administration. Secondly, it acknowledges that this administration is going to put that threat at the highest level and respond to it and put it in a equivalency to other terrorist threats, international terrorist threats. And that means not just a whole of government approach, but a whole of society approach. So I think those signaling functions before we even get to the meat of the strategy are very important.
We should mention that federal officials have noted the threat of domestic violent extremism before. We know in 2017, the FBI reported white supremacists posed a lethal threat. There was in 2019 a framework presented by then acting Secretary of Homeland Security Kevin McAleenan to counter violent white supremacy. When you look at the Biden strategy, what are the effective parts? What's going to make the difference this time?
Well, a strategy is just that, right? It's words on paper that, you know, establish, in this case, pillars of activity that's going to be taking place. But you're right to suggest that, you know, what's going to come from it? What does that mean is going to happen on the ground? And I think, you know, that in some ways remains to be seen, but there's already much that has happened even before the strategy was published, right? We've seen the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security announce measures to try to eliminate extremism within their ranks. We've seen more money requested for resources for combating violent extremism. So there's been already steps taken, and I think that's what we are going to see more of. There's a lot of plans in this document for things, and I think things that are so important, like providing more information international to federal to state to local and the reverse, so that there's a better coordination, there's a better understanding of the threat, and a better ability to actually counter it. I think that, you know, you're going to see actions taking place to try to reduce the impact of disinformation and other extremist rhetoric that fuels extremist violence online. You'll see efforts to undertake that. And I think we'll see, just as we're already seeing post January 6th, a real emphasis from our law enforcement agencies to combat this threat. And that is an area where they need to really be able to reach out to the communities, build trust from communities who sometimes don't trust law enforcement to be able to really be effective in this area.
Well, you know, Mary, some of that broad information sharing has raised concerns among some groups. So let me ask you about what is not in the strategy. The ACLU's National Security Project Director, Hina Shumsi, put out a response to the strategy saying, quote, the strategy includes none of the civil rights and liberty safeguards that rights group and communities of color have long sought. We know in the past, Mary, counterterrorism measures have resulted in abuse of power and over-surveillance of communities of color, Muslims in particular. Is there room in this strategy, you think, for civil rights abuses down the line?
So I think, again, the strategy is really not at the level of detail where I think we'd be seeing exactly where the vulnerabilities to abuse are and what kinds of measures need to be taken to prevent that. So I very much appreciate Hina Shamsi's comments. I do think A.G. Garland, as well in his speech today, as well as the document itself, makes clear that everything that's being proposed is being proposed to be done within, with respect to civil rights and civil liberties and constitutional values. So I think the devil will be in the details. And I think Hina Shamsi will be raising good points as we move forward and we see actual actions, policies, and, you know, potentially legislation, although not necessarily, and other actions that the Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, et cetera, that they take to implement that, that's where we really will need to be looking to see that civil rights and civil liberties are protected.
You know, Mary, all of those agencies for two decades have been focused almost exclusively on an entirely different threat, right? Mostly a foreign threat. We're talking about violent Islamist extremism. Culturally, can you get all of those systems of power to pivot? Especially when you look at, as we reported earlier, you know, we know what happened on January 6th. There were military veterans. There were law enforcement officials. There was a former member of Congress in the crowd outside the Capitol that day.
So I think that it's right that the overwhelming resources have been put toward the international terrorist threat since 9/11. But it's not as though this threat was ignored. I mean, as you noted already, Director Ray, you know, has been saying now for a couple of years, has been emphasizing the significance in terms of lethality of the domestic terrorist threat. We've seen cases brought by the FBI and the Department of Justice, not only post January 6th, but over the last few years, numerous cases brought to disrupt threats, because obviously they'd prefer to disrupt a threat before a terrorist attack happens. But you're right, that, you know, this is a much more of a mandate for change here. And I do think that the federal government, you know, has enough power and authority and Congress through oversight to ensure that directives are being implemented and that there really is a change in resources. I think getting the states and locals also on board might be even a bigger challenge, and that will need to be incentivized through some of the grants that are given from the federal government to states and locals and have some strings attached to those grants that include this type of prioritization. So I think it's going to take all of those efforts. And, you know, starting, frankly, with, you know, renewed emphasis put on vetting and screening of government employees who are in positions that sensitive positions or positions of dealing with the terrorist threat. And, you know, looking at current employees, and I'm really talking about here about our military and our law enforcement, and making sure that we don't have extremists in the ranks, because even though they have First Amendment rights, they don't have a First Amendment right to be law enforcement. And extremist views, racist views, those things are incompatible with the role of law enforcement and the military. And there is leeway within our constitutional framework, courts have told us, for government employers to take action to eradicate those types of extremist viewpoints, violent, anti-government, racist viewpoints from law enforcement and the military.
That is Mary McCord, formerly of the Justice Department, now at Georgetown University. Mary, thanks for being with us. Always good to see you.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 19, 2021, so I have been told. At the equinox, right? End of spring, beginning of summer, transition in lots of different ways on the planet right now. Weekly compensatory call-in here at the context of white supremacy. Opportunity for non-white people, victims of white supremacy, to exchange views on what has taken place last 7 days or so. Suggestions, thoughts, questions. The number to dial, 720-716-7300. The code 534-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. 564-943-pound. Press *61 to raise a hand. Things to share before we get to some of the folks who dialed in. One, we'll be here tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific, earlier in the day. Looking forward to checking in with some of our folks in different parts of the world, particularly kind of see, you know, what forecast are they getting for the summertime? Is it business as usual, no more Rona, or, you know, a little bit more cautious approach to warmer weather? We'll check in tomorrow, see what folks around the globe are saying. Next up on a lengthy list of things to share from the week. Let's see, get my list of notes up here. I guess number one, I should have said this beginning, I'm all about no holidays. If nothing else, folks can say Gusty, many of the folks at the Cows are kind of consistent about some components. Holidays, you said the same stance, people who tuned in for Halloween, Christmas, Thanksgiving, St. Patrick's Day, birthdays, like pretty much anything you can think of. Same stance, no celebrations. We are still on the plantation. Let's celebrate when we've solved the problem. Same would apply for Juneteenth. In my opinion, just extraordinary white supremacist shenanigans all week long. To have suspected racists, Joe Biden. I said, man, Joe Biden is going to be central for two of the most historic moments in Negro history. The election of Barack Obama, he'll be right there. I was the wingman, so-called, vice president, right there. He wouldn't have done it without me. And then the signing of Juneteenth. He'll have a few more, too, the super predator crime bill and all that. But, I mean, Joe Biden will be right there, front and center. Moments in black history. Knew what he was talking about. He said, you're not even black if you don't vote for Joe Biden. Now we have Juneteenth. That's payback, see? He wanted to look out for his homies. We had his back. Now he has our back. Juneteenth. Anywho, no celebrations. Was rather gaudy this week. Man, I don't know if it was Juneteenth or the end of spring, but this was like a really, really unpleasant week in a variety of ways. Like, it was so bad. I saw the report when they did all the hoopla about Juneteenth, federal holiday. I guess for some people, if you got federal time off or if you got a paid holiday, I guess, you know, that's worth whatever it's worth. Fine. But I saw that report and I was going to share online like, wow, this is an accurate summation of my Thursday, which was a really awful day on the plantation. It's so bad I posted that. A Cows listener said, oh, wait a minute, Gusty. You forgot this one. Wham! And he posted. Apparently they made, oh my God, I saw it twice. So he posted they made a mural of George Floyd because we love black males. They made a bust of George Floyd. Or I'm getting confused. Make sure I get my stories right. So this one, they had a full statue, life-size statue, maybe even larger because it looked huge, of him sitting down. And they had a picture of some black people seated with the statue of George Floyd at the big unveiling. And the woman had her hand, I guess it looked like she was putting her hand on his leg maybe, but it looked like she could have been grabbing at his genital area. And I just thought, wow, like if I get choked out, knee on my esophagus, nigger knocker on my Adam's apple, they put me in the chokehold and, you know, crush my larynx, whatever it is. I get shot 180 times, whatever it is. I do not want a statue. I do not want any t-shirts. Do not spray paint images of my likeness around your town or anywhere else. Like, I feel like that is the most tacky bit or demonstration of necrophilia and Negro consumption after the black person is dead. Oh, we love George Floyd so much. So that was one. I said, man, like, really? We got to, every dead black person, we're gonna make a statue and a mural to them? Follow that. So that was, I don't even know what part of the world that was in where they got this life-size bench statue of George Floyd. Then today, the Brooklyn Nets have a big home playoff game, and they started off the whole affair with Juneteenth celebration, and they had black entertainers with kente cloth singing Negro anthems, and people were being very emotional. They showed overweight black people outside the stadium, and they had a bust, get it correct, not a statue, a bust, just the head likeness of George Floyd. And they had obese black people who were kneeling and seemed to be very emotional and offering a prayer for George Floyd. I have no idea, like, what this has to do with, you know, a playoff basketball game. I don't know if George Floyd, I mean, I thought he was in Minnesota. Maybe he was a Brooklyn Nets fan. Minnesota, I guess, is close to Wisconsin. Maybe he was a Milwaukee Bucks fan. I don't know. Do you kneel in prayer, Brother George? If you can help us get this game 7, Brother George. We will pray for you after the game, Brother George. We will have a Nets jersey in your honor, Brother George. Just help us. Help KD get this one for us, Brother George. Is that what it is? It just, that's another one too. Like, I can't imagine that under any circumstances, but if Gus T, the police, or any other white person, badge or no, if they kill me, I do not want any ceremonies at a Mariners game or Seattle Storm game or Kansas City Chiefs, the local team, any of that. Maybe they do have the Atlanta Crackers down in Georgia. If they wanted to do a ceremony for Gus T at an Atlanta Crackers baseball game, I would be all right with that. I used to have an Atlanta Crackers t-shirt when I was in Atlanta. It had a picture of a white man swinging a bat on the front of it. Woo, that's one of my favorite t-shirts of all time. Loved it, loved it, loved it. Next on the list, the first segment, I didn't intend on including it. I already had the audio segments together, and then I was looking at the news and was like, wow, reparations for so-called Indians, non-white people. They found all these remains at a so-called indigenous school. Wow, we have talked about that many times on The Cows. Kevin Annette was a guest on The Cows many years back, 2010, and he talked about some of these schools in Canada where they were snatching non-white children. I thought it was really significant. They talked within that segment about making the children forget, not speak their native tongue, punishing them for doing so. You're going to speak the white man's language, how that was integral to the whole brain trashing process. I thought that was really important. But I said, man, if we're looking at remains of schools, what about down in Florida? We talked about that. I think they continue to dig up remains down at the school. I forgot the name of it, but we had some of the guests on the program, black males, where they were raping children and beating them. They had white and black children down at the school, the Dozier School. That's it, the Dozier School. How could I forget? Named after one of the former governors. But if we're talking about reparations, like, my goodness, like, pull out the checks, Governor DeSantis. Pull out the motherload of checks, in fact. Anywho. Didn't intend on playing that, but it certainly is relevant sometimes. Hey, how much can you play? And the segue, right, I didn't intend on playing it, but I played that, and then we went right to, they talked about actor Ned Beatty and him passing away past few days, and they said the film that he is most known for, Squeal Like a Pig. Now, that, and they said that was his first role. That's not some lame, no-budget, whack film that, you know, just immediately to home movie. No, indeed, ma'ams, sirs. The late Burt Reynolds was in that film in his what they call heyday, lots of what they call star power, and that is considered a classic. Deliverance, I suspect if anybody who takes a film class or you do any study of U.S. cinema, Deliverance is going to be on most people's lists for their top, you know, 100, 200 films. For a lot of people, it's going to be higher than that. It's older now, and it's still considered a classic. It's been almost, or it's been 50 years. Still widely considered a classic. That film, the iconic scene, is Ned Beatty being anally raped. Squeal Like a Pig. Even 50 years later, when Burt Reynolds passed away, because that wasn't that long ago, when he passed away, that was one of the first films that they mentioned. He has a large body of work, Mr. Reynolds does, Suspected Race Soldier. But Deliverance, that's one of the first films that they will mention. He's right there, canoeing down the river for the rape scene. Now, why is that so iconic? Why does that have such a place in white culture? And I would say, even pause for a moment now. Hey, the enduring legacy of swine and sodomy, a white man raping another man in films. We can totally skip over Pulp Fiction, right? Even though, you know, Harvey Weinstein and all that. We can skip Pulp Fiction and the Ving Rhames scene. Let's go all the way to the favorite that we've talked about, Black Mirror. The number one episode in Black Mirror, white man forced to rape a pig on television. Why is that a recurring theme in the system of white supremacy? These scenes in major films and television programs that win all kinds of awards. Every film I just mentioned win all kinds of awards and become, you know, pieces of cultural identity for that, you know, specific time period. Why is that? A white man raping, and they just talked about that in the book club. Suge Knight, maybe he raped Anthony Harrell to get the contract. Maybe that's how he did it. He pulled his pants down. I'm going to anally rape you. That is a part of someone's culture. Someone does brag about these anal rapes and seems to think that raping another man is entertainment. Why does that keep popping up in a film? Who says, yeah, we got an idea for a film that started, and that rape scene is early, Squeal Like a Pig. That's early. That's like the first 30 minutes of Deliverance. Like, who greenlights that film? That's what, we're going to budget this film. Who gives the thumbs up, as they call it? Yes, we're going to put hundreds of thousands of dollars and make commercials and everything, and young children want to go see this. Who says, yeah, the film where the guy says squeal like a pig and we have a nice explicit anal rape scene and it's even hinting at bestiality? Yeah, that sounds like a blockbuster. Let's do it. Squeal Like a Pig. Let's see. Next one. They talked about the bariatric surgery for people, teens especially, suffering from extreme obesity. Our not number one of Judith Finlayson. She was a guest on the program a couple weeks back, and she talked about the obesogenic environment. The surgery may be helpful. They said it is and offers immediate results. They said it's not offered frequently to non-white people. No surprise there if it's constructive. But I also just came back to thinking, like, man, everything about this environment is about setting people up to be obese and unhealthy, especially non-white people, in a variety of ways of setting people up to be unhealthy and overweight and eating bad foods and all the rest of it. So the bariatric surgery, this is my first time even hearing of it. So it may have constructive benefits and all the rest of it. But wow, if maybe, just maybe, if there wasn't a McDonald's and a 7-Eleven, a Whopper stand on every corner where non-white people are concentrated, maybe if they didn't subsidize all of the sugary concoctions. Maybe if organic produce was subsidized, maybe we would have healthier folks who did not need bariatric surgery in the first place. Just a thought. Oh, before I get, I mentioned Juneteenth and forgot the portion from the segment. Now, when I played that segment about, it was not Juneteenth specifically, it was about eviction, but they started with Juneteenth. They came out and they said, we just recognized Juneteenth as a federal holiday. And so in that light, we'll examine the evictions moratorium is expiring, and this is going to have a tremendous impact on Black people. And I said, wow. And that was an NPR segment. They are really clowning. Like, that's how we're acknowledging, celebrating, recognizing Juneteenth, Negroes being thrown out in the street. Like, oh, it is going to be wonderful, isn't it? We can get all your kente cloth and sit out on the curb and celebrate Juneteenth. Isn't it wonderful? Oh, at least it's summertime, so you won't be out in the snow. You have that to be thankful. You can. We plan Juneteenth to be in the warm weather. We know you all don't tolerate the cold too well. That's totally what it felt like to me. I have no idea what Juneteenth has to do with Black people being evicted. But it seemed to me if they can solve problems doing the stimulus checks, other types of ways to help people, it would seem to me they could probably solve this problem with the evictions, make sure the landlords are satisfied, they get their money so they're not hurt, and you know, all the rest of it as well, but that people are thrown out. It would seem if we're just coming out of a health pandemic, that might be a little risky as well, have lots of folks who are in unstable housing situations. No, evict the Negroes. God, Black Lives Matter. Yes, yes. Juneteenth from the curb. The Black Farmers segment. Now, they just, we talked about that like, what was that? Maybe 2 weeks ago. We've had a few segments talking about the Black farmers and a part of the stimulus package that was supposed to be specific aid for Black farmers. And this is, you know, a small bit of compensation for decades of white terrorism and Black farmers being mistreated and not getting constructive resources in a timely manner. In that segment, they talked about how a number of Black farmers were skeptical. Said, hey, we've had years. They had a lot of metaphors. Remember, they said, you put your hand in the hole one time, get bit by a snake. You come back, put your hand in the hole again, get bit by a snake. You come back the third time, you're going to be, what do you think's going to happen? And I said, hey, metaphors. If it was more specific, they've practiced racism against us for decades. We're always hesitant. They might say they're going to do this, say they're going to do that. We'll see. Like, that's much different. That's much more explicit than metaphors and talking about snakes and what have you. Lo and behold, we wait literally days. We don't even get out of the season. And whoop, not so fast. Said we're going to give you some money. Not going to give you anything. Now, even within this segment, the metaphors return. This time around, they said the Black farmers, when we come to get, we're going to get a few crumbs. They're going to give us a few of the crumbs. Let's be explicit now. Are we getting accurate compensation? Or are we not even getting correct compensation? Because crumbs suggest that you're not getting a full portion, right? You're not getting a full slice of cake or pie or whatever it is we're divvying up if you're getting crumbs. He says they're going to give the Black people crumbs, and now they have ants in their pants. Now that one, I got to pass it over. Does James Brown have a song? Isn't that one of the James Brown hits? I got ants in my pants and I need to dance. Isn't that James Brown? Now, that might be an age thing. Maybe he grew up and that's his generation. And, you know, I love some James Brown, so I'm going to get my James Brown plug in anytime I can. Victims guaranteed qualify. But if I'm talking about white supremacy racism, I might be like a Drake fan, Rihanna, Jay-Z, Beyonce, Kanye, Love Yeezy. You can pick your artist that, hey, I'm a fan, whatever. When I'm talking about white supremacy racism, that might be the time to be a little bit more precise, specific, really making an effort to craft our words and how we speak about this problem. I've said for a long time the reliance on metaphors, I think it does a lot to aid the system of white supremacy, because a lot of time these metaphors, they are saturated with white supremacy, racism, and commentary that suggests something awful and evil and vile about black people, blackness, and the exact opposite for white. So try to be specific about things. I don't know what that is, but with the farmers segment over the weeks now, lots and lots of metaphors when it gets to talking about terrorizing black farmers so that we don't have folks who can produce their own healthy food for us to eat, so we don't have to rely on Cheetos and McDonald's and Burger King. Speaking of food, I will pause. I've posted lots of pictures. Anybody, if you are looking for like, what will I call it? Plant-based inspiration, right? Trying to switch your diet up so you can eat healthier foods. You can follow facebook.com/theproblemiswhitepeople. I hate Facebook, all the social media, TikTok, Instagram, all of it. I hate it, hate it, hate it. I only use it for the context of white supremacy. If I was not doing this program, I would delete all of those accounts today. But I do make an effort to post food just so that people can see. You can make lots, and I mean all kinds of plant-based meals that are tasty. You don't have to miss out on anything. I used to eat terrible foods all the time. Could dine at 7-Eleven. I'm sure we have people internationally. It's like the worst, tackiest, lamest, unkempt, unsanitary convenience store chain. And they have ridiculous, unhealthy foods, hot dogs being one. I used to get those and Slurpees. That would be like lunch and dinner some days. Slurpee and hot dogs. You can't change, number one. But two, you can make lots of anything. Like I used to love nachos too. They have nachos there too that are ridiculous and gross. But I had nachos yesterday that are light years better than what I used to eat at 7-Eleven. Pictures on my Facebook page. I have a black female that I know. She works at one of the grocery stores that I love shopping at here in the Seattle area because they have spectacular produce. And she's worked there for a long time. Always super courteous when I see her and talks about eating better. She had talked about during the whole shutdown, I guess, about not being able to get out as much, not being able to eat as much, it being stressful and feeling like she had put on weight, wanted to do better about that. And she said she was moving to go be with her granddaughter. She said, I'm a grandmother. Not, you know, how I say, not old, but not, you know, wanted to be with her grandchildren. Said, hey, I said, that's spectacular. Go spend some time with your daughter and be a grandmother. That's the best thing ever. She said, yeah, there are better things, more important things, getting my priorities together. And I said, man, I will, what's your favorite dessert? She said, cheesecake. I said, I will hook you up and make a cheesecake, blueberry cheese. I said I was doing everything blueberry. I'll do a blueberry cheesecake. And while I've never been a cheesecake person, I was not like in any component, like eating cheesecake, making cheesecake. I've never been to the Cheesecake Factory. I think the closest I've ever come to the Cheesecake Factory is when they looted the downtown Seattle Cheesecake Factory location after George Floyd was murdered, and I walked by the ruins a day or so afterwards. That's, I think, the closest that I've been to Cheesecake Factory. Made vegan, in fact, gluten-free, plant-based blueberry cheesecake. I was so nervous, way more nervous than I've been about pretty much anything, any other cooking that I've done that somebody else is going to eat, just because I've never done cheesecakes. I don't eat cheesecake, and she says she's a fan, so I thought, you know, she might not be pleased, but it turned out so well. Wow, it's one of the best things that I've made. And to be able to gift to another black female, like, wow, she thought it was spectacular. Like, the texture is a little different, obviously, from dairy and all that, you know, cow nonsense, but wow, it was so good. Like, I seriously, like, contemplated saying, oh, man, I found a hair in it. I'll have to take this back, or accidentally sneezing on it, or, you know, anything that I could have thought of or come up with to repossess that cheesecake. Like, I even said, I would have been an Indian giver happily for the day. Like, yes, now give me my cheesecake back. Anywho, it was great. Support other black people being healthy. Not that cheesecake is, you know, healthy by any stretch, but that you could have that plant-based, not even any honey in it. Sparkling pictures on the Facebook page. That's it. Already got in my plug about metaphors. If we could refrain from using them for the broadcast, that would be amazing. Race soldiers often use metaphors to be deceptive. Victims, myself included, frequently we are still learning. So sometimes we just don't have all of the data to articulate our thoughts logically. Sometimes we'll use a metaphor until we get the logic to articulate our thoughts. Frequently, that just causes a lot of confusion. If we could make an effort to be precise, exact, specific with our commentary, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt, as I said, about the metaphors. If you need more time to formulate your thoughts, that is always allowed and encouraged. That's it. Let's see. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, that would be super appreciated, just to make sure everyone gets at least one chance to share. If you have extra thoughts, questions, just make sure everyone speaks at least once, and then you can come back, share any other thoughts, commentary that you have. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, kind of get to a quieter area. That way you can speak, share your commentary, and then mute your line. And then if you have additional thoughts, you can unmute, kind of get back to that quieter area, and rejoin. Just using the mute button helps. That way we don't have to contend with a lot of unnecessary problems and noise. That said, let's see. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, *61, if you have commentary. Line should be open. Let's see. Folks are spectating or whatever it is. Let's see. Retired firefighter in Florida. Got you. Well, I guess other folks get their thoughts together.
Greetings to everyone. My only report is I have been just about all of this week thinking about this event, quote-unquote celebration, called June 19th, trying to understand the logic of it all. It doesn't seem logical. Even the history behind the event in itself. We're under a global system of racism, white supremacy, and have been in that status, non-white people, for centuries. And I just think that the saying of, well, we're going to celebrate this, meaning I think in code it means that white people are going to recognize there is such thing as a celebration of the date June 19th. And in some kind of way, that is supposed to become either some sense of resolve or a total sense of resolve of the global system of racism, white supremacy. And that is one of the most ridiculous things that that I can think of. But unfortunately, I would assume that it has made some impression, unfortunately, on more non-white people than I would like to think so. And that's all I have to say right now to that particular whole thing. I mean, I would say something like 2 weeks from now, 2 weeks ago, I would say a lot of people didn't even know it existed, you know, in itself. And now all of a sudden it's a quote unquote national holiday. I gotta, like Dr. Welsing say, I gotta give, the white supremacists an A+ in how they can easily promote something that doesn't have any depth to it at all. And, no tangibles at all. And, you know, just smiled about it and said, we did something. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. That is absolutely accurate. like they get lots and lots of celebration for silly things, things that are not constructive, like, yeah, they trick us, as you said, Dr. Welsing, A+ for racist man, racist woman, racist child. And why I'm a big advocate of, you just do the same thing that we do any other day. No holidays, there's nothing to celebrate in the system of racism, white supremacy. Nothing to celebrate means nothing to celebrate. So, no, I don't, and I don't even know what the celebration is for Juneteenth. Like, what are we celebrating exactly? Like, if slavery is still in existence, like...
Doesn't make any sense. At all. So what, you weren't informed... You weren't informed of something when it happened. It didn't really happen. Something called emancipation of slavery. That to me is code for the end of racism, white supremacy. It still exists. Anyway, maybe I'm the dumb one.
Might be the two of us, as they say. Because, yeah, it does not make sense to me either. Like, but birthdays and all that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me either. So, you know, maybe I just missed the boat that something really constructive happens when you get to pick out certain days and say that this is going to be a special day for some reason, or a holy day or whatever it is, and we are going to celebrate. We're going to cut a fool and wear special hats and have special songs and all the rest of it. Maybe that, you know, does something that I have missed out on. But this one specifically, Juneteenth... Nope. Thus far, I've not seen any of that, and I didn't celebrate it before all of this. If you, like I said, anybody, if you get holiday pay and all that, I am not mad at you. Get your nickels, as many of them as you can, time and a half, whatever it is, right on. But that is not cause for, you know, we got to stop and celebrate and whoop it up and all the rest of it. Like, yeah. Anywho, if something constructive associated with all of this has happened to you or that you know about, other than overtime pay or something like that, please let us know. 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I actually saw a report. It reminded me so much of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. I was talking about sound while folks are spectating. I guess either getting their thoughts together or if nothing really stood out, maybe they're all at the Juneteenth Jamboree. But this report was in Scientific. There might be. Maybe it's just us. You know, we're the
slow ones. Maybe. Or celebrating their birthday.
Hey, and if you got a birthday on Juneteenth, like, woof, you can cancel the rest of the month. We'll catch you in August. Scientific American, they had a report. It says, or it's titled, "How Can Sound Be an Ally? How Sound Can Be an Ally or an Enemy of a Healthy Brain." Now, this reminded me of Dr. Welsing. Folks recall, she spent a lot of time, especially towards the end of her life, where she talked about all of the racket in near her residence in the Washington, D.C. area. I believe there was some sort of preschool where there were a lot of young children. I think she said they were so-called Jewish children or a Jewish daycare center. And she said they just made all kinds of noise. And she was someone who invested a lot of time in thinking, high-level, deep thinking, an author, writing books and traveling all over the world to give lectures and serious presentations and studying and watching the news and, you know, making an analysis of that and then having patients and doing psychiatric work and the rest. So someone who is about serious scientific study, a physician, and having lots of noise is not conducive to that. She used to talk about that all the time. About how for black people, especially black people encouraged to be in areas not just with food apartheid, as they call it, where you don't have access to healthy food, but then you got all kinds of noise. The transportation center has got to be in your neighborhood and the airplanes got to fly overhead and we got to put the garbage collection center where the niggers are and all the rest of it. That noise, another form of pollution. Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste, one of my top 10 books. So this report, not reading the whole thing, skipping down quite a bit, actually. It says noise is more pernicious than in the moment nuisance. Even a modest level of noise over a long enough period of time, for example, what did I just say? Beeping garbage trucks, hair dryers, air conditioners, can cause damage to the brain networks that extract meaning from sound. Many of us don't even realize our brains are being blunted and our thinking impeded by this invisible force. It seems most everyone is aware of the dangers that loud sounds can inflict on our ears, yet long-term exposure to sounds that are not loud enough for us to give them a second thought can cause permanent damage to the hearing brain. This is different from what we typically think of as hearing loss, which involves damage to the hair cells and the cochlea by noise, aging, and certain drugs. Sobriety would be best. Instead, it's a disruption of some of the connections between the hair cells and the higher brain areas, which has been demonstrated in research on lab animals. So you might pass a hearing test because the hair cells are still working and some of the connections are still intact. Some of the connections that carry important information like speech, however, are missing. And they go on to give other problems and what have you. But they talk about just having nonsense noises. I said the garbage truck, the bus. They mentioned the air conditioner, just random little nonsense noises that are there that you might not even think of, how that can just dull your brain computer so you are not as receptive to sounds and things that happen in your environment. I think Dr. Welsing, she used to talk about that. She would say, get where you can just sit someplace quietly and think. Quiet your mind. Think about things that are happening around you. Might give yourself an opportunity to think of the solution to our problem. Then this was in Scientific American, just something for thinking about our environment. They talk about if you have the ability, they don't mention racism, white supremacy, but if you have the ability to try and be in a quieter environment, I guess this would be a time again to plug. I am in Seattle, Washington, sitting outside. Not even any wind today. No need. I don't even have to use my mute button. I can stay unmuted if I wanted to. I just have to make sure I don't snicker too much. Number again, 720-716-7300. Decode 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If folks are spectating, like maybe they're at the Juneteenth celebration, Jamboree, and that's what's going down. But if folks don't have any commentary to share, we can wrap up early, do other things. Maybe we should have been at the Juneteenth Jamboree. We could have had some constructive dialogue there or seen what constructive activities they were engaged at the Juneteenth jamboree. Speaking of all, I don't even remember that. Like, I'm not saying that they celebrate this everywhere. Like, it might depend on where you are. Like, if you grew up in, I don't know, Wyoming, Massachusetts, maybe they don't celebrate Juneteenth. You know, maybe it's not a big deal there. Maybe if you grew up in Arizona, maybe Juneteenth is not a big to-do. I don't know. But I don't remember celebrating Juneteenth or that being a big holiday or something like that. Like, I don't remember any Juneteenth parties or events or anything of that nature. Like, when I was growing up, if somebody recalls that, maybe I just was in a neglected area, had a neglected childhood. You all can, you know, feel free to let me know all of that. Let's see, our other caller in Florida, if you have comments here, you should be with us as well.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I didn't get a chance to hear much of the audio segment. I had some family members over. Now, one thing I noticed this morning now, to be frank, was my older sibling had a shirt that had a fist on it. It was a black shirt, and it had a fist on it. And it had like W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King, and a lot of names of victims of racism throughout history, as they call it. So I'm like, man, what what could this shirt, you know, be about? So I didn't get a chance to ask or anything, you know, just part of my personal code. But I'm thinking it may have something to do with the Juneteenth celebration, I guess, going on. I wanted to mention that. My next one is, here locally, there is a black female, right? Her name is Dionne McGraw, Alachua County. She has been taken from her seat by the governor. Well, the governor made her title, I guess, vacant, Governor DeSantis. And she defeated someone in a contest for the school board, and this person isn't black, of course. So they came up with a means to attack this black female, Ms. McGraw. They said, "Hey, you know, you stay in this district. You don't live in the district that you got votes from," or something like that. So she has been removed. And this has caused some questions to come about, like, I don't think they use the term racism, but it seems like that's where it's going. And this just happened like this week sometime, Tuesday, Alachua County. I wanted to mention that one too. I think racism is involved in that. And Gus, there was an article, New York Post. It reads, NYC psychoanalyst calls whiteness incurable, quote, parasitic-like condition. It was, if you wanted to read it, it's under New York Post, June the 10th, 2021, and it's under a guy named Dr. Donald Moss. I know a part of it says, whiteness is a condition one first acquires and then one has, a malignant, parasitic-like condition to which white people have a particular susceptibility. An abstract of the article of Sage Journal says, the condition is foundational generating characteristic ways of being in one's body, in one's mind, and in one's world. Parasitic whiteness renders its host's appetites voracious, insatiable, and perverse, states the paper. So I guess this guy's some kind of a doctor, this white person. And I read the article a few days ago. I just wanted to bring that up in case, I don't know if you read it or not. And that's all I had to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Very interesting. Caller in Florida. I had not heard that article or read that report or heard about it. Donald Moss, PhD, white man. He has a website, apparently, so checking out his website. People, if they want to check it out, Dr. Donald Moss, all together, no dots or spaces or anything like that. DrDonaldMoss.net is the website if you want to check out his other writings and all that good stuff. Have to check out that report. I have to check that out to read exactly what he's saying. Maybe we can have him on the program to get more details. He can break it down and explain it for us, what all of that means, and if he has any proposals for how we solve this problem. But yeah, I'll check out his website. Thank you kindly, because I had not seen or heard about that information at all. The fist on the shirt, I don't know what that means either. Maybe it's connected. It's Juneteenth, man. See, me and retired brother Imani, see, we are just, you know, we don't know what's going on. See, we're slow. We're messing around. Everybody else, they got gear and they are at the party and they are doing it up for Juneteenth. Victims guaranteed qualified. That's all I can say. Like, I guess if he wasn't at work and that's the shirt that he wanted to wear, right on. No problem there. Maybe he wanted to show some regard for W.E.B. Du Bois, victim of white supremacy, attempted counter-racist. I don't know. Or a conversation starter. Maybe he was hoping, he knew he was going to be around some other attempted family members. You know, that's something to get up a little dialogue about racism. Maybe throughout the summer you'll get a chance to bump into him again and you can ask, what does that shirt mean? What's up with the fist? The Governor DeSantis and I guess the removal or vacating the seat of Ms. McGraw. Not surprised. I just mentioned Governor DeSantis before. I said he should be cutting out checks for the Dozier School. They were talking about reparations for the school. And he's vacating black people's seats and saying that's the same thing he said, that that's the same thing that they do. They will come around aggressively for a black person. Say, oh, wait a minute, man, you don't live in this school district. Man, you got to go to jail and your mother has to go to jail. We're putting all of you in the Dozier School because you lied and you live five blocks over. You're in a different school district. Like, they will come around and aggressively police that sort of thing, say, up, you got votes from this district, and up, you cheated. We got all kinds of voting irregularities in the Sunshine State down in Florida, apparently, all kinds of them. And it seems like black people are to blame. Remember the end of the year, they had a black female, I think this was closer to where retired firefighter is, this is in South Florida, and they said, we got voting irregularities and we have lost faith. And this black person who apparently worked at the voting pool or whatever it is, and they said there was some sort of problem with the ballots or whatever it is. I have to go back to look. I think she even had to lose her job. Like, they pressured her. She had to resign or something like that. Like, I have to go back and get her name, but it wasn't that long ago. Anywho, much obliged. Caller in Florida. I'm going to get her name as well. We'll check as we proceed with the broadcast. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If we got any folks who, as I said, if you have participated in any Juneteenth jamborees, if you got holiday pay or anything else for Juneteenth, you can let us know that as well, or have any other thoughts. I wanted to make sure I got in also the segment where they talked about all of these firearms that have gone missing from the military. I thought that was so important, beyond just the great equalizer, as Dr. Welsing always called firearms in the system of white supremacy. But I mean, they didn't say a six shooter. They didn't say one sniper scope. They said a few grenade launchers, a few rocket launchers, AK-47, like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, man, you let retired firefighter try to walk out of the fire station with one fire nozzle and see what type of alarms, sirens, investigation. One of the Opa-locka 3 has stole a fire nozzle, much less a rocket launcher, an AK-47, a grenade launcher. Now, this is another one. We are in the system of white supremacy racism. This is one of those, just like in the prison, where they say, man, there is no way we can have drugs in the prisons unless the prison guards are doing the set. Like, the warden has got to be in on some of this drug trafficking. The prisoners cannot be doing this themselves. Same logic would apply in the system of white supremacy racism. There is no way you have rocket launchers, grenade launchers going missing, and these folks, military officials, they're not involved. They don't know how this. They, and then the metaphors that they were using, they said, you know, if one sock ended up with the other sock in the laundry, this would be okay. We are not talking about you and your raggedy laundry. I mean, you want to talk about responsible journalism. We're talking about missing assault rifles. Every time that they get on after a shooting, pick one. Sandy Hook, pick one. Pulse, pick one. They whined about that this week. Pick any of them. Stephen Paddock out in Las Vegas, every time that they come out and whine about one of these shooters, we used to be thinking like, whoa, is this one of those stolen military assault rifles? Whatever, like, whoa. Not lost laundry and a missing sock in the lavatory or what have you. That's not what we're talking about at all. Just, I thought that was super important. If that, in my view, if there was any suspicion Black identity extremists were responsible or had something to do, if it was the group not effing around, if they had something to do with it, oh man, imagine Al Sharpton, National Action Network, they're suspected of stealing or trafficking somehow rocket launchers, grenade launchers. They talked about reporting, said people aren't talking about this and newspapers, companies struggling right now. And that's what we miss sometimes with this type of journalism not being active. Come on. They would have talked if it had been Gus T, Black identity extremist. They would have found time to talk about it and talk about it. New bills would have been passed and all the rest of it. Just thought that was important. As the case in Canada. Not unrelated, the case in Canada where they had the white man who was charged with terrorism for killing those four non-white people, family members, Muslims, about a week or so ago. I can't even think of another white person facing terrorism charges. Like, I can't think of another time. I think the Tsarnaya, I don't even think they faced terrorism charges. Do y'all remember the Tsarnaya? I have to look to see if the Tsarnaya brothers in Boston, if they faced terrorism charges. But there was dispute about whether or not they were even classified as white. So I will have to take a gander to see. But I thought that was significant. And I mean, wow, I can't even think of, you know. I don't think Dylan Storm Roof, I can't think of another white person, even though it's not in the United States. I can't think of another individual classified as white being charged, particularly for killing other non-white people. like, wow, we'll have to see what happens with the charges and all the rest of it. But suspected terrorist, white man in Canada. Correct. Accurate use of words. And he was practicing a little white privilege. A white terrorist who went out to, in my opinion, in a cowardly act, too, to go take a vehicle and run down a family. Like, are you serious? Like, standard. I think Dr. Gerald Horn, the last time he was on the program, he talked about that, the numerous cowardly acts of white terrorism. You can't even go and address someone and have conflict with them one-on-one. Just go, I'm going to go run them over with my car. And he's 20 years old, too. It's not even 20. Not, again, Donald Trump trying to blame it on all. No. 20-year-old white man. Let's see. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. While folks are hanging out, any other thoughts? If folks are spectating, like I said, if we are just missing out on the, you know, shindig of shindigs with Juneteenth as an officially white recognized holiday, well, we can all get out of here and go party down in about 10 minutes or so if folks don't have any other comments to share. The folks that are with us, anything else? Let's see, retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just want to make a brief report on quote-unquote civilians getting access to not only just firearms, but firearms that normally are in the hands of the U.S. military, the different factions of what is called the U.S. military. From our understanding, the quote-unquote U.S. military, Coast Guard, Marines, Army, Air Force, Navy, do not make their own firearms. These firearms come from private companies. And, you know, like auction-like, they basically sell their firearms to not only the U.S. military forces, but military forces all over the world. They sell their firearms. And in turn, I would think logically that most of the employees of these places are white people, from the executives down to the guy who with a screwdriver in one hand screwed the trigger on to a AR-15. You know, are white people primarily. There has got to be at some point in time where a white person through that entire process, you know what, why don't I, you know, take this thing home with me? either piece by piece, or, you know, it's enough of them where they do it everywhere else. I mean, heck, I wouldn't be surprised if some white people have access to a vintage nuclear device, but the only thing about it, they can't use it because they'd be too close in proximity to it where it would harm them if they exploded it, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, it's just logic to me, you know, that, you know, through that process that there is a level of white people who are taking those firearms off of that work site and have it for their own private use. You can look at YouTube, and there is you can watch it for a week. The amount of showings on YouTube of just about every weapon that you can conceive white people use privately. They are large acreage areas where they are utilizing tanks of different types, as far as back as World War II tanks, machine guns. I'm talking about heavy machine guns. You can't even carry these things. They have to be mounted on something. And the only thing that they don't show you is that they do not have explosive heads. Whatever cannon it fires out of, they don't have explosive heads. The only explosive part is the part that gets the shell out of the funnel, that sort of thing. Because you know, it exploded, you know, in a small amount of area, it can actually do some harm to the elements and whatnot, that sort of thing. So, but I mean, I'm pretty sure white people have access to those things on a daily basis, you know, that sort of thing. And they may let a few of them come with in the areas where black people stay at, but if they're only to the limit to whereas we can harm each other with those weapons. That's on that train that stops on 79th Street in Liberty City. You know, that sort of thing. Like an AK-47 or something like that, which, you know, it'd be a situation whereas they're quite secure that non-white black person will only be harming other non-white people. And those are just my thoughts on that.
Absolutely. Where will be non-white people able to harm and be reckless with other non-white people? Not where they're going to be the ones who are harmed as a result of this. Absolutely. Makes logical sense to me in every way. Incidentally, I will say, I know we've had folks who talked about black people wanting to own firearms. I'm not opposed to that at all. We've went out shooting, retired firefighter or not, went out and did some shooting at the gun range in a safe manner. He helped us with lots of his own expertise. All of that said, I do not see any constructive value at all to going out and parading with firearms, like any sort of public demonstration, marching, walking, stomping, standing, sitting, riding, none of that. I do not see any constructive value to any of that behavior. I have not seen where any of that solves one problem, a half of a problem, like nothing. If anything, I have seen where that creates new problems. So I'm not sure why this needs to be said in 2001. It seems like the record should speak for itself, as they say. Metaphor? I think it's self-evident. That's not a metaphor. That the lots and lots and lots and lots of times that a black person or groups of black, especially when it's groups of black people, have gone out for any sort of public display brandishing firearms, nothing good has happened. Like, that'd be another one. Can they point to one time anywhere in the known universe a group of black people came out with their guns, rocket launchers, pea shooters, whatever it is, and as a result, like, wow, the black people in that area came up. Like, they got houses or new businesses or jets, something, stock options, something, bag of potato chips. If y'all can think of one such instance, let me know. But yeah,
none at all, and it doesn't frighten white people. The white people as a whole, it doesn't frighten them at all. I don't care how many non-white black people that are carrying around guns, marching in South Carolina or somewhere. You know, it doesn't matter. They're not afraid of that.
Very. Now, I don't know if that's the goal. Maybe the goal is not to frighten individuals classified as white. Maybe the people who go out and do, because I've never participated in these events. So if that's not their goal, then, you know, they can let me know what they hope this will accomplish. But absolutely, it does not in any way, shape, or if anything, from what I've heard, white people get excited with that sort of thing. Like, whoop, whoop. Look at this. Honey, look, you saw the McCloskeys. When the black people came rowdy through their neighborhood, they went and got their assault rifles and came out on the porch. They didn't go inside and cry. and go hide in the attic and say, oh my goodness, the Negroes are coming to get us. What is we going to do? Oh, Al Sharpton's on our part. That's not what they did at all. Pled guilty this week, but I mean, whatever. They went and got their rocket launchers and assault rifles. I wish one of you would step foot on this here yard. That's what I've seen happen pretty consistently. Like, they have much better, many more firearms, much more expertise, like, all the way around. Like, I've never seen, like I said, ever, where the result of this is, you know, racists are afraid, we're going to leave these niggas alone. Like, whoa, did you see them? They were out. I'm like, wow, we better not ever mistreat them. I'm not even going to say the word nigger for the rest of the week. Like, I'm not familiar with it. I've never heard of, read, seen, nothing of the sort. Like, I can think of the opposite, though. Many instances where, as a result, this created more problems for black people. Sometimes, created more problems for black people who weren't even at the march or demonstrate. Like, they weren't out brandishing anything. And they ended up getting caught up in all this, too.
Right.
Just saying. Let's see. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks are spectating or don't have any other thoughts to make sure that they get in. As I said, we'll give it about 5 minutes or so, and then we'll call it a broadcast. We will be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, White Supremacy. We'll gleefully check in with our folks in different parts of the world, see what they are up to, how they are responding to the whole Rona situation and all that. They do not have Juneteenth over there, I don't think. I think this is just one of those goofy U.S. holidays like Thanksgiving. So, yeah, they'll have non-Juneteenth related news, perhaps. Let me make sure I did not miss any of the news report. The whole thing with Nicole Hannah-Jones, I appreciate what she said. This is the non-white female with a white parent in North Carolina where she's being denied tenure. We had a report on that today. She's a victim of white supremacy. She's done a lot of work on white supremacy, racism, and education specifically. But I look at this report, I think I put on social media, if it was Dr. Tommy Curry, Dr. T. Hassan Johnson, Dr. Niana Rasayan, it was a black male, two black parents, four black grandparents, and they were being denied tenure because of their views, commentary on white supremacy, racism, would this be getting all this attention? I was very curious. I'm not saying that it is or isn't. As I said, Nicole Hannah-Jones, she is a victim of white supremacy. But that's the same thing I said with President Obama. Having a white parent and then that black misandry, it's really hard for me to see, like, CNN and all these other major outlets, if it, Dr. Tommy Curry, Dr. Gerald Horn, if he was being denied tenure, let's say, you know, he's got all these goofy books on white supremacy and no tenure for you, Dr. Horn. If that were the case, really, would it be this type of and like on and on and on and weeks of, you know, really? Within that segment with Nicole Hannah-Jones, I did super appreciate where she said she was talking about the field of journalism and how who is doing the one that's reporting is important. And if it's consistently told where it's just the white perspective, then that has an impact. And where they're able to practice racism, white supremacy with what they don't cover, what they do cover, how they cover the incidents. Jeffrey Toobin and the like are the ones who tell the narrative about O.J. Simpson. And she talked about being objective. And I thought back, we read Dr. Marimba Ani, and she said that that entire concept is absurd. No one is objective, quote unquote. The best thing would just be to, you know, be honest about whatever your biases, leanings are as you write. But I mean, even whatever you choose to write about, whatever your subjects of interests are, that means that that is subjective, you know, whatever you're picking or choosing to write about and then how you write about it and all the rest of it. So, I mean, yeah, there's absolutely no such thing as objective when it comes to journalism, particularly within the system of racism, white supremacy, rife with metaphors and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I always appreciate pointing that out consistently on the broadcast. Let me see.
This service is provided in high definition. Access code accepted. There are 9 participants in the conference. Q&A session has started. The recording has started.
I guess I lost you.
Got disconnected briefly. They were, I guess it was Juneteenth, overloaded circuits with all of the, you know, jamboreeing and partying going down. But yes, back now.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if you heard me, Gus, but did you get my report that I sent you about Mr. Davenport?
Oh, my goodness. I did not. Let's get it again, sir, please.
Oh, yeah. Basically, what I did, I sent you a text. I was just doing some surfing on YouTube, and it was two showings of Mr. Davenport's child. It's to be the next star. He looks to be somewhere around 7-8 years old. The reason why I say that is because all of his quote unquote baby teeth are out of the front of his mouth. And so I imagine that puts him at something like the 7 or 8 year old age, and he's the next football star. So that would probably answer, let's say if you did have him on a Kyle's program, it would probably answer a lot of your questions, especially the ones about whether or not you would allow your child to play football.
Wow.
He is featured in YouTube running for touchdowns. You know, my issue not only with football, but any sports that are basically incorporating and or recruiting non-white black people, especially black males. It's not as bad with females, primarily because with the female sports it doesn't garnish that much money. But with males, and in turn it affects black males, is that primarily there is no influencing that is effective to where as it could be to influence these young people for much more things that you can get from participating in sports. I'm not just talking about football, but participating in sports that you can get based on what you earned, you know, with that, you know, like a scholarship and whatnot, that sort of thing. What you can get as far as quote unquote a college education, employment of different types. It can be the foundation anyway, based on your athletic talent, you know, that sort of thing. And if not the influence of it by others other than coaches, even coaches don't really do it, let alone talking about parents and whatnot. You hardly hear anybody speak about anything when it comes to sports other than you can end up being in the NFL or the NBA. You know, when it comes to black males, primarily it's football and basketball. You know, that ultimately disgusts me. I was involved as a football coach for a very long time, and I've always used that platform, attempted to use that platform to basically state, well, utilize this athletic ability for things that would get you places long after you cannot play the sport. And it's not enough people that is that's trying to influence young people in that way. It's not enough at all. And I'm talking about including people who are coaching. Black males, other black males who are coaching. It's not being promoted that much or at all, hardly. You know. But anyway,
that I did send you. I sent you that report. Maybe it's because it's two numbers you sent me. So maybe if I put it in the wrong one. Yeah.
I'm sure you have it accurate. I just need to give a second look to double check the information.
Okay.
It's been, yeah, wacky transition. I said end of spring and all the rest of it. But I mean, wow, that is victims guaranteed qualified, as I've said frequently. But wow, that would be interesting, I guess. His son being so young. I know definitely at that age, like, wow, if we're talking baby teeth and all that, like, it's absolutely not supposed to be any tackle. Like, it should be all two-hand touch or flag football, you know, what. I hope on these YouTube videos, hopefully it'll be him running touchdowns with two flags that are on his waist, showing that he has not been hit. And that his brain computer is safe, no tackling involved, so he can be safe and injury-free as he continues to mature and gets a full set of nice, I guess no metaphor, nice pearly whites, because I'm talking about his teeth. So, yeah. But yeah,
football is a religion down here in South Florida. Now they do have the non-violent form of football called flag football, touch football, but it's just like everywhere else. It's done. It's something that you do in the off season, and the white recruiters make money off of it because they make money off of all of it. Actually, they form that to be able to keep the players active, so when they come around the colleges and whatnot, come around scouting, looking for their next black superstar athlete that would make them millions of dollars, they will have them functioning in a football-like form so they can make a better evaluation of them than just them standing around. They're not playing full contact football, but as far as with the skill position guys, quarterbacks, receivers, running backs, that sort of thing, they can still see some sort of potential. So in the off season, where actually it's no such thing as an off season anymore, but in the season when they're not being violent with one another, they would have them with the flag football type of thing, one-on-one type of drills. It would, with these camps that these white people finance and worked in concert with the Alabamas, the LSUs, the University of Miami's, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. I am very aware of the religion of football, not to be confused with the religion of white supremacy in the Florida area and Texas and some of those other regions where they take it very, very seriously. And like you said, we on the chance that you might be one of those who can make millions of dollars and we can rob you and your family while you get brain damaged and bust up your whole body, we want to, you know, simulate it the authentic way, you know, so show that you can perform in a professional football setting, you know, all that type of nonsense. And notice how they can get that serious. They don't get that serious about black people and academics, right? Saying we're going to work against racism and got all these protocols and get it set up and we do it just this way so you can go right on and boom, boom, you're prepared for the next. Nah. Just for football. So you can go out and get brain damage for our entertainment. And then have the Jerry Sandusky and all that along the way where they can paw on you and rape it. Dr. Gerald Horn, he talked about that. Sexual abuse started the program with that deliverance. Folks satisfied? Mm-hmm. Anything else they need to get in or we good for the broadcast?
I was just going to give one model of what I view as someone who took full advantage of the scholarship earning in sports,
black male. I can't think of his first name, but his last name is Roe. He is a relative of a guy that I worked with for about 25, 30 years. He was a straight A student through grade school. He made the transition from high school to Florida State, became a, you know, nationally known football player, straight A student. He actually played in the NFL for about 3 or 4 years. No longer than that. He's now is one of the top brain surgeons in the world. His last name is Roe. I just can't think of his first name right now. I forget.
Spectacular. I love it. Preserve your brain computer, preserve your body. Like, there are lots and lots of things that we can and should be doing with our bodies and brain computers other than going out and brutalizing other black people, because that's generally who, especially down in a place like Florida, if you're doing high school football or whatever, this little fella, Mr. Davenport's offspring, battling and damaging the brains and bodies of other little black boys and what have you. Like, forget all of that. Like, we can find healthier things to do with that time and energy. And think retired firefighter for years has said, hey, I just use this as a means. Tell them you can be doing other things. Use this for other things. Get a scholarship or be thinking something beyond just I'm running around and doing this with the, goofy. Goofy, unrealistic, childish thought that you're going to go to the NFL or the NBA because, the vast majority of you, that is not going to happen. So let's get that silliness out of your head now and get back to other things, serious things like brain damage. All of that said.
I just had to figure, Gus, that you got to go where the young people are at. And that's where a lot of our boys are at. They're involved in sports in some sort of fashion or way.
Logic. Hopefully, we can use a little bit more of that, try to solve this problem. Folks have been out at the Juneteenth Jamboree. Be safe and constructive. Let us know how it was. Hopefully, you can take some pictures and post them online. Maybe they had some really yummy food at all the festivities. We'll be here tomorrow. No Juneteenth overseas, so Global Sunday Talk on Racism. 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. We'll be here. Tune in if you have questions, want to talk to some of the international participants. That's it. Thanks to the folks who listen live or archives. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best. Man, they talked about, even with the noise report, they talked about how some narcotics can damage your hearing. Sobriety. If you are going to go out, I say, hey, be alert. They had that report talking about the number of guns that have been stolen. Be mindful about, hey, what is happening? Who is around you? Are they acting crazy? In my view, this is not the time to be confronting random strangers publicly, verbal confrontations and the like. You should be thinking like, hey, this person might have one of those military hookups, might have a rocket launcher, like might be Stephen Paddock. I don't know. When I say Stephen Paddock, that was the white fella who killed like 50 people in Las Vegas, had a whole arsenal of firearms, might have had a military hookup for some of his firearms. I don't know. But that's what you should be thinking. If not, this person might have a whole entourage of folks who are with them and ready to do damage. If you didn't leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, exit. This is not the time to be getting in somebody's face and all the rest. Might be a Frank Ligo on your hands. You don't know if this person went to the gun range today. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.